You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Norman Finkelstein. He received his PhD from the Princeton University Politics Department in 1988 and is the author of 10 books that have been translated into 50 foreign editions, including The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering, and most recently, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. His books also include What Gandhi Says About Nonviolence, Resistance, and Courage. His website is normanfinkelstein.com. He will be speaking at World Beyond War's annual conference this September in Toronto, Canada. Norman Finkelstein, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. What do you make of the latest outrage in Gaza?
Well, the Israeli reaction was predictable. What's much more important was the Palestinian action, not the reaction. The Palestinians are now testing the possibilities of mass nonviolent civil resistance as a way to, at least initially, end the illegal, immoral, criminal blockade of Gaza, and then to proceed to achieve their full national rights. And so far, the Palestinians have in Gaza have, I think, been quite impressive in the, first of all, the magnitude of the mass mobilization. It started out with several tens of thousands, but it's quite clear that the momentum is building, the dynamism is there. People there are very enthusiastic about the possibilities of this kind of tactic and are joining in all sorts of creative, autonomous, and independent ways. So I think if they can maintain the three conditions for success, well, there are several conditions for success. One is unity, two is discipline, three is persistence, and four is transmitting a simple, reasonable, and uncontroversial goal, objective of the demonstrations that will rally international support. If they manage to do all that, and it's a big agenda, I'm on the last one to deny it. If they manage to do all that, maintain unity, maintain discipline, persistence in the face of Israel's brutal provocations, and put forth a simple, uncontroversial, and reasonable objective that will galvanize international support, I think they can end the blockade.
I'm very glad to hear you're encouraged. Your comments raise a number of questions. One, I guess, is what do you mean by discipline? Does that mean nobody doing anything that the Western media can depict as violent? Because that seems almost...
I think that's basically correct. They have to make sure that they don't justify Israel's violent repression, and they don't create a pretext for Israel's violent oppression. That's tough. People there are very angry. Many people have been killed, brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers, cousins, uncles have been killed over the last 8 years. Israel has unleashed 3 massacres in Gaza since 2008. There's a lot of pent-up anger. There's a lot of desire for revenge, and it requires a huge amount of internal discipline to control those impulses in the name of the bigger struggle.
I read the headline in the Washington Post that said, quote, Gaza protesters torch tires along border, draw Israeli fire. Right, so guns don't kill people. People kill themselves by drawing the bullets out of the guns. I mean, I haven't found a single headline in which the Israeli military actively does anything. It's all the blame is all on Gaza. I mean, it doesn't seem possible for them to get themselves depicted as nonviolent.
I don't agree. I think they're registering important successes right now.
Yeah.
The Human Rights Watch put out a good description of what happened. The Office of the Human Rights High Commissioner put out a good statement, and Israel's finding it very difficult to justify its murderous sniper. They weren't the snipers, really. They were assassins, the 100 assassins they posted on the border in order to kill Palestinians, shooting them as they fled, shooting them in the back, shooting them while they're praying. And as Human Rights Watch pointed out, there is a scintilla of evidence, not a scintilla, that the Palestinians had any firearms. The worst that can be said is they were throwing some stones. So the Israeli brutality is clear. And it'll take time. You know, the Washington Post, like the New York Times, these are the last bastions of Israel apologias. So it'll take time, but they're planning on at least a month and a half. And remember the Montgomery bus boycott. It took a year of discipline, unity, persistence. Workers had to get up at 4 a.m., walk to work several hours each way. There were the carpools. It was winter. That was an enormous undertaking. And the Israelis are as dug in, they're as racist as the white Southerners. So it will take, it will be a require a lot of persistence. But just as the white Southerners managed, just as the African Americans managed to desegregate the South, I think the Palestinians will manage, if they persist, at least as an initial objective, to end the siege.
Yeah. I have seen people praising Chris Hayes on MSNBC for relatively accurately depicting what's just happened in Gaza, and apparently not being forced to recant the way he was when he once questioned worship of U.S. troops. I don't know if you've seen that segment, but it is a little encouraging, I think.
Well, these are all opportunists, and actually that's a good sign, because when you see opportunists blowing in a different direction, it means that the protests are having the desired effect.
What about your statement that a clear and achievable objective is needed? Is the objective the right of return, or is it, or should it be something else?
Well, the official call of the demonstrators is a march for return and to end, lift the blockade. Unfortunately, in all the coverage thus far, the second goal has been, the goals have been truncated and reduced just to the first one. But there are two goals. My opinion, the focus has to be on the second goal of lifting the blockade, which in the short term is an achievable goal.
Yeah. What can people do to make clear that's the demand?
Well, the first responsibility falls on the Palestinians. They have to articulate clearly, in my opinion, they should reverse the order of the goals, and they should focus almost entirely on the first one. But these are things that you can't dictate from outside. You can make suggestions, you can make recommendations, you can advise, and you can counsel. But there are a lot of contending forces and factions in Gaza, and you have to navigate complex and sometimes treacherous waters as you try to present a consolidated movement.
I think you've said in the past that Hamas and Israel have a mutual interest in wildly exaggerating Gaza's weaponry and military prowess, but presumably the people of Gaza don't share that interest. How do you overcome
Hamas
that?
Hamas is listening now. It realizes it reached an impasse. It realizes it reached a cul-de-sac. It realized it reached a dead end. It realized that the Armstrong not a viable option, and now they're testing something else. So let's wait and see. It's a steep learning curve that they're going to have to go through now if they're going to achieve anything in the short term. They have to, as the expression has it, they have to remake themselves. Now, it's not entirely a reinvention, because Hamas did participate in the first Intifada, so they do know what mass nonviolent civil resistance is about. But the first Intifada is about 30 years old. It's a new generation, and it's also, as I've already mentioned, an angry. They're very angry. They've been brutalized. I can't even find the right word for what's been done to them the last 8 years.
Yeah.
And it's going to be good. It's a tough call for them to maintain that discipline in the face of the Israeli provocations. But from what I'm hearing, it's looking good. The people are excited. And one of the things that Gandhi said about nonviolence is being borne out by this. Whenever you have armed resistance, armed struggle, it reduces to 95% of the population to passive onlookers. And it's only about 5% of the population that's actually engaged in the resistance. But when you adopt the tactic of mass nonviolent resistance, you can you can summon up everybody. And the Gazans are now engaging everyone, all ages, sexes. I understand on Monday they'll be bringing children to commemorate Martin Luther King's assassination. They are going to engage what is their most and has always been their biggest asset and resource, and that's the people.
We're speaking with Norman Finkelstein. His website is normanfinkelstein.com. One of his books is What Gandhi Says About Nonviolence, Resistance, and Courage. Go ahead.
Nonviolence resistance. Yes, correct. Thank you.
I think it's very encouraging what you're saying. I wonder about people in other places, including Israel and the United States, whose government provides billions of dollars of free weaponry and immunity at the United Nations for Israel's crimes. What do Gandhian lessons suggest that people in the United States and the rest of the world can and should be doing?
Well, there's a lot we could do. I think we should be building towards May 14th, which is their climactic day. And there should be mass demonstrations, sit-ins, all forms of civil disobedience, hunger strikes. This is the moment of truth. The people of Gaza, since 2006, have endured a 50-year-old brutal occupation. They've been a gradually escalating or deteriorating, whichever image you want to use, blockade of Gaza. The blockade of Gaza reached its climaxes after Palestinians elected Hamas into government, the first democratic elections in the Arab world. And then in 2007, when Hamas consolidated its power, resisting a coup that was engineered by the United States, Israel, and elements of the Palestinian Authority. And then this brutal blockade, which reached its peak in 2007, has been punctuated by the periodic Israeli massacres in Gaza, climaxing in July-August 2014 with Operation Protective Edge, which left 1,600 Palestinian civilians dead, including 550 children. 18,000 homes, Palestinian homes, were pulverized. The demonstrations now are reaching their climax on the 14th of May, and we should be ready to support them. And I hope the Palestine Solidarity Movement will get into action.
I hope that in the United States, the Poor People's Campaign, the new Poor People's Campaign, which is planning events around that same time, will take this up in solidarity. I will certainly suggest it to them if they aren't already. What about ships to Gaza, activists going on boats to try to bring supplies to Gaza? Has that been useful? Should that continue?
I think if they're targeted for May 14th, that would be perfect, yeah. I think there are all sorts of things that can be done.
Yeah.
And all sorts of things that have to be done. Because heroic, courageous, and indomitable as the people of Gaza are, they simply can't do it on their own. But they also, on the other hand, they have to be the ones to initiate. We can only support. We cannot do for them what they don't do for themselves. And right now, they've found the inner strength, the courage, the will, the conviction to take on the Israeli behemoth. If we do our share and they do what needs to be done, I think they can win.
Well, obviously, one thing we need to do is spread the word about what's happening.
That's correct.
With radio shows and every other means. But what about boycott, divestment, and sanction approaches toward Israel from the rest of the world?
I don't think they have a pertinence right now. I think we have to figure out ways to support a concrete action. And I don't think at this particular moment we should be focusing on BDS.
In the long term, perhaps, but not now because...
It's an ongoing thing, but you have to adapt your tactics to what's happening at the moment. And the moment, there have to be ways to figure it out to support the demonstrators.
Yeah. What about the problem of the role of the U.S. government, though, for people who live in the United States and the interest that U.S. weapons companies have, including in the pretense that these so-called missile defense systems work? This is central to...
The United States is a very tough nut to crack, especially right now, because Trump's in power. And Netanyahu is his biggest cheerleader and ally in the world. And because the Senate, the leading Democrat is Charles Schumer, the Senate minority leader, who's actually worse than Trump on Israel. So between the two of them, and it's a very tough nut to crack right now. However, there are things that can be done to mobilize public opinion.
What should we most be working on?
Well, exactly what you said. There has to be education about what's happening. There has to be a revolution, even a linguistic revolution. Israel keeps calling that fence a border fence. It's not a border fence. Who's on the other side of the border? That's not a border fence. There's no state on the other side. That's a prison fence. That's a ghetto fence. That's a concentration camp fence. Those are not my words. Haaretz, Israel's most respected newspaper, referred to Gaza as, quote, the Gaza ghetto. One of Israel's leading sociologists, Baruch Kimmerling, all the way back in 2003, he referred to Gaza as the biggest concentration camp ever. David Cameron, the conservative British prime minister, he referred to Gaza as an open-air prison. Well, if it's a prison, a ghetto, and a concentration camp, then that's not a border fence. It's a prison fence. It's a ghetto fence. It's a concentration camp fence. We have to get the terminology correct. You know, Confucius famously said, the first step towards wisdom is naming snipers, really. I would call them assassins. They were put there to assassinate civilians. Now, Israel says every shot that was fired was accurately landed on its target.
Right.
So when a Palestinian is shot in the back fleeing, a Palestinian is shot while sitting and praying, according to Israel, those were accurate shots. Those are assassins.
During the last assault on Gaza, I collected statements from various Israeli officials about how the Gazan people needed to be treated. They needed to be attacked. They needed to be raped. The young ones needed to be killed so they didn't grow up into bigger snakes. They needed to be put on a diet and reduced. And so, what is the accurate terminology for what Israel is trying to do to the people of Gaza?
Oh, I think the accurate terminology, Israel's official goal is to force them into submission. But then you have to look at the tactics that they have adopted in order to force them into submission. And the tactic, it seems to me, is pretty straightforward. The UN agencies, humanitarian agencies, economic agencies, they all agree that Gaza will soon be, and may already be, unlivable. 97% of the drinking water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. So each time a child drinks that water, the child is being poisoned. And Gaza also is hermetically sealed. So how do you describe a situation where a population of 2 million, 1 million of whom are children, are locked up, caged in an area which is biologically, medically unlivable. Now that may, Israel's goal may be to force them into submission, but it seems to me that their tactics now verge on genocidal.
Yeah. There actually is some activism, whether appropriately focused or not, among young people here in the United States related to Israelis' wars and crimes, more so, I think, than against U.S. wars. And I'm hopeful that at our conference in Toronto in September, you'll have some advice for U.S. and Canadian and global peace activists, albeit a very large task to take on. What advice would you give to people who are trying to reduce militarism around the world?
I don't have any special advice apart from the obvious. That remember, this is about trying to achieve something practical, not trying to cast radical poses. Everybody's entitled to and should nurture their own ideologies for what's the best possible outcome, the most just outcome. But for the moment, we have to achieve practical victories. Otherwise, people despair, they walk away, they lose interest.
Right.
And so we have to make sure to set goals which are achievable and also have substantive results. And we should not set goals which exceed viability just to show how pure and radical we are.
Well, of course, we just have a few minutes left. We don't know, of course, what's achievable until we've achieved it for certainty. But one focus that a lot of activists are looking at in terms of U.S. militarism is closing certain foreign bases where we can build alliances between peace activists in the United States and people who live near the unwanted U.S. bases in other countries, and trying to stop construction and get some of them closed and those troops sent back to the United States. Is that the sort of tactic that's worth approaching because it might be viable or not?
I have no idea. I mean, these things can only be judged on a case-by-case basis. And by people, activists on the ground, who know the lay of the political land. And it would be really presumptuous of me, to say the least, to be sitting here in Brooklyn, New York, and saying whether this or that is achievable. Politics is a, and the thing about politics is there are 10,000 variables. And as you said earlier, you don't really know what's achievable until it's been achieved. I think that's true. There are so many variables that it's impossible unless it would be presumptuous. I don't want to say impossible, but it would be really presumptuous for somebody who doesn't know in a concrete situation the 10,000 variables that a particular objective involves to make a comment.
Right. So we look into the details and proceed accordingly, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
2 minutes left. I really enjoyed your book on Gandhi, on the complexity and the contradictions and so forth. But it seems kicking the British Empire out of India would be one of those goals that would sound the least viable to anybody if it were proposed. Am I wrong on that?
Well, you have to remember, Gandhi didn't propose that goal until pretty late the day. Originally, he was fighting for equal rights within the British Empire. He didn't call for independence until pretty late in the day. I can't remember. It was in the late 30s or the mid-30s, 1930s. It takes time to figure out what works and what can work. The most amazing thing about Gandhi, which was also the most amazing thing about Mao in China, was these were not countries or nations, India or China, in any sense that we understand them, because they were so completely fragmented, and this was pre-modern communications, and how they managed to carve out a nation using the most primitive forms of communication, how they managed to arouse an entire nation that felt itself as a nation. Those were spectacular human achievements. These are far-flung countries with populations that far exceed anything we can imagine. And yet Gandhi, walking from village to village, town to town, city to city, at most on a railway. And the same thing with Mao, though I don't recall Mao ever actually using a railway,
right.
Managing to unify these far-flung populations with the most primitive forms of communication. It's not just a daunting achievement, it's an incomprehensible one.
Well, we will keep trying to comprehend it. Norman Finkelstein, his website is normanfinkelstein.com. Thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You're welcome.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Supreme Court has just ruled that a woman shot four times by a police officer, though she posed no threat to him or anyone else, has no grounds to sue because he has an immunity that means if he didn't understand he was violating her rights, he wasn't. We'll talk about trying to use the law to protect communities from excessive force with Peter Biebring, Director of Police Practices at the ACLU of Southern California. Also, a judge has approved an agreement to screen the children in Flint, Michigan for learning disabilities. U.S. District Judge Arthur Tarnow said that's a win-win situation for all sides. Flint residents will no longer receive free bottled water from the state, whether their tap water is safe or not. But there's more. Michigan also says Nestle can extract more spring water from the state at no cost to sell for profit. Flint residents who now need to buy the water they're forced to use for washing, cooking, and bathing don't have to buy it from Nestle, but that would bring the whole game full circle, wouldn't it? Peggy Case is president of Michigan Citizens for Water Conservation. We'll talk to her about Michigan's, but not only Michigan's, struggle over the right to water. All that's coming up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Amy Hughes was not suspected of a crime. She was standing still outside of her home in Tucson holding a kitchen knife by her side. Three police officers responding to a check welfare call about a woman hacking at a tree arrived and saw Hughes's roommate, Sharon Chadwick, in the yard and Hughes some 6 feet away from her. An officer yelled at Hughes to drop the knife. It's not clear whether she heard. Neither two of the three officers called to the scene nor Chadwick herself felt that Hughes was threatening. The third cop, Andrew Casella, felt differently and, without warning, shot Hughes four times through a chain-link fence. She survived and did not go quietly, suing for the violation of her Fourth Amendment rights. The Supreme Court, however, has just ruled that Casella can't be sued, that he's covered by something called qualified immunity. Among myriad disheartening aspects in this case should be included the idea many had that there was a greater chance of making charges of excessive force by law enforcement stick in Amy Hughes's case because she isn't black. Although she has a history of mental illness and people with disabilities, along with LGBTQ people, are also disproportionately likely to be shot by law enforcement. Well, what can we possibly see as the lesson of the court's ruling in this case? And where do those who seek accountability, not to speak of justice, go from here? Peter Biebring is Director of Police Practices at the ACLU of Southern California. He joins us now by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome to Counterspin, Peter Biebring.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Casella versus Hughes was a 7-2 ruling, not a close one. Sotomayor, with Ginsburg in the dissent, said that the decision, quote, tells officers they can shoot first and think later, close quote. Is there another possible interpretation of what the court has said here? What do you make of it?
I mean, I think Casella is disheartening for anyone who expects the Supreme Court to provide a meaningful check on police shootings and excessive force. First of all, there is the standard that the court uses in evaluating police force cases under the Fourth Amendment. That standard does not require that an officer who shoots do so only if there are no other alternatives. There may be other alternatives that officers could have pursued, but the Constitution, as this Supreme Court has interpreted it, does not require officers to use deadly force as a last result. The second issue in the court's opinion is their interpretation of a doctrine called qualified immunity, which is, you know, it's a little bit technical, but basically a doctrine that says courts shouldn't hold police officers liable, shouldn't even allow officers to be sued unless their conduct was clearly against the Constitution. And one of the things that the court said is that because there wasn't a case exactly like this one, the officer, even if this conduct was a violation of the Constitution, wouldn't have reason to know. That is a very troubling holding here, because the court didn't even let the case go forward because it held that a reasonable officer could not even have known, that would not have had fair warning, that the Constitution might prohibit an officer from shooting in this situation. And given the facts that you described, it's really extraordinary. It's worth emphasizing the officer shot Hughes through a chain link fence. There was no question that the officer's lives were not in danger. The only question was whether Hughes posed an immediate danger to the person standing next to her, which was her roommate. And the testimony showed that they were chatting and that Hughes seemed contented and, you know, not agitated in any way. But the court still said not only it wasn't a matter of a jury having believed the officer's account over Hughes' account, the court held that on the facts, even if Hughes provided evidence of them, that the case could not go forward. The issue is that the federal constitution and civil suits for damages, particularly under the construction that the court has given in this case and in prior cases, just doesn't provide a meaningful check on police use of force. Part of that is the standard of reasonableness that doesn't require officers to use deadly force as a last resort. Part of that is the doctrine of qualified immunity that excuses officers from even shootings that might be unconstitutional if there isn't a prior case that clearly indicates that. But another reason is just that money damages are not a very good deterrent anyway. There's research that shows that individual officers effectively never pay money damages. It's always the government, the local police agency, that pays. And the way that budgets are set up, that is never an effective deterrent. Either that money comes out of the city's general fund, or even if it comes out of the department's fund, it's budgeted for it, and departments that run over their budget simply ask the municipality for more money. So if we are going to stop unnecessary police shootings, we need to change the rules for when police can shoot. And that is why communities and advocates in California have introduced a measure to change the standard for when police can use deadly force under California law.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to move on to, because cases like Casella certainly encourage a person to think that the law is just not going to be the arena for justice on these issues. And that's why people are in the street, you know, but we also need a multi-front fight. And so it's very interesting to hear that in California, there is some possible forward movement in terms of policy or law. So maybe tell us more about this Police Accountability and Community Protection Act.
The bill, which is
Assembly Bill. I'm sorry, Bill. Yes, yes.
Yeah, the bill, which is Assembly Bill 931, carried by Shirley Wember, an assembly member from San Diego, would change the state law that authorizes police officers to use force and be explicit that deadly force should be used only when necessary, only when alternatives such as using de-escalation tactics to defuse a situation and avoid force, or using lesser alternatives, when those aren't reasonable in the circumstances. It would also make clear that an officer's use of force would be evaluated not just on their decision to pull the trigger at that particular moment, but on the officer's entire course of conduct, so that an officer who effectively creates a circumstance where they're under an imminent threat might still not use force legitimately under this standard. And a good example of that is, under the current constitutional law, an officer who jumps in front of a moving vehicle might be faced with a deadly threat of a vehicle coming towards them and could potentially fire and kill the driver, even though they both created that circumstance by jumping in front of the car and might have had alternatives as simple as stepping out of the way.
Right, right. Right. Well, what do you make then of the response? I mean, people knew as soon as this came forward, and this is, of course, an immediate response to the killing of Stephon Clark, but of course, in really bigger picture response to the thousands of killings by law enforcement of unarmed people, of people holding things that were not guns, of things in which, you know, we were constantly being asked to consider a decision made by law enforcement reasonable, even when a person captured on video, you know, appeared to be posing no threat. All of this led up to the putting forward of this law or this bill in California. And we could expect a big pushback from it. And here it is, you know. And so we have the Los Angeles Police Protective League saying The new proposal demands that officers have a Monday morning quarterback's perspective before game day on Sunday, you know, followed by, if enacted, it will either get cops killed or allow criminals to terrorize our streets unchecked. Pick one, you know, and then the putatively sympathetic that I've heard, which is, well, this is just going to change the words that cops use when they try to justify excessive use of force. How do you respond to that?
I think it's important to recognize that a number of law enforcement agencies across the country have adopted elements of this law, and some have adopted all of the elements of this law, mm-hmm. and they've worked to reduce force and have not resulted in either higher rates of assaults on officers or injury to officers or in higher crime rates. So first, some major law enforcement organizations, the Police Executive Research Forum and the International Association of Chiefs of Police, both associations of police management, have put out recommendations about use of force policies that recommend departments adopt higher standards than the constitutional minimum. Part of the problem is police officers are essentially authorized to use any force that isn't illegal under the federal constitution. We can ask more of our police than that. Some departments have, in fact, adopted these higher standards, particularly those that were under U.S. Department of Justice supervision. So Seattle, Chicago recently adopted a higher use of force standard, and New Orleans and some others. And in Seattle, there's very clear evidence that since adopting a higher use of force standard that requires necessity for deadly force, that looks at the officer's entire course of conduct, that requires de-escalation, all the elements of this bill, their use of force has dropped, their crime rate has also dropped, and there has been no evidence that the use of force standards have put in officers in any greater danger. Officers haven't been subject to assaults or additional danger because of this standard. So the bill puts in place a common sense rule that police should only shoot people when they absolutely have to, and one that has proven effective.
We've been speaking with Peter Biebring. He's director of police practices at the ACLU of Southern California. You can follow their work on this and other issues online at aclusocal.org. Peter Biebring, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
It is impossible, really, not to connect two recent pieces of news. Residents of Flint, Michigan, have been told that the state that poisoned their drinking water will no longer provide them free bottled water. They'll be going back to paying some of the highest prices in the country, some $200 a month, for water that may still be making them sick. The Washington Post reports at least 12,000 homes in Flint still waiting for a replacement of lead pipes. At the same time, Michigan approved a permit letting the Nestle Corporation pump more fresh water out of a well in the Great Lakes Basin to bottle and sell at a profit, more than 500,000 gallons a day, the right to which will cost Nestle, wait for it, around $200 a year. And that won't increase, though the amount of water they're taking will, by 60%. This is, in fact, how water rights work in this country. But if it feels wrong to you, you are far from alone. What can be and what is being done? Joining us now to discuss this critical story is Peggy Case. She's president of Michigan Citizens for Water Conservation. She joins us now by phone from near Traverse City. Welcome to Counterspin, Peggy Case.
Thank you.
This Nestle in Michigan fight is a new fight for many people, but it's not for you. When news articles refer to the years of fight that Nestle, the biggest food and beverage company in the world, has faced since they moved into Michigan, a lot of that fight has come from your group, hasn't it?
Yes, that's how our group was formed, actually, back in the year 2000, when we discovered that Nestle was pumping 400 gallons per minute from a spring well in McCosta County, Michigan. When they put up the bottle plant was when people realized they were even there. So our organization formed way back then to oppose it because there were already damages showing up to a stream and a lake, and the environment was already being impacted with that level of withdrawals. It took a 9-year court battle and $1 million to win a case. It was a partial victory. We didn't get Nestle out of there. They had to reduce their pumping by a half, down to 218 gallons per minute. And the judge ruled that anything more than that is damaging to the environment. So that's a court precedent case that still stands on the books. And it's important to know that because 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, Nestle applied for a permit to increase their pumping at a well in Everett, Michigan, 20 miles down the road where the original battle was, to 400 gallons per minute, the exact amount that they were told they really couldn't take from Acosta. It's spring water, which is bottled as Ice Mountain, and they were given an increase of 100 extra gallons per minute with no public comment, no chance for anybody to go through the proper procedure. And we think that it really violated the existing water withdrawal laws. Then they tacked on another 150 when they applied for the 400 permit. So it gets very complicated after a while, and your head starts to spin. But the bottom line is that Nestle's wanting to take even more out of a stream that's already damaged. So, of course, we're contesting that again. On April 2nd, Nestle was granted the permit for 400 gallons per minute. 80,000 people sent in public comment. Out of those 80,000, only 75 thought Nestle should pump and get that permit. The rest of them were all opposed to it. We were told by the Department of Environmental Quality that those comments don't matter, that they were following the rule of law and they could grant the permit. Now, we know that they intended to grant it all along, so it depends on how you read the law. They read it in Nestle's favor. We say that it can be read quite differently, can be read to show that that permit can't be delivered. So there's several issues that are unresolved that should have been resolved before the permit was issued, and one of them has to do with the township. The township denied a permit for a booster station, which is necessary for them to be able to increase their pumping to 400 gallons per minute. And so Nestle took the township to court. The judge ruled in Nestle's favor. The township voted unanimously almost to appeal that ruling. So that ruling is still sitting in limbo, and it's still a contested case, which means that the DEQ should not have granted a permit when there was a local issue that was unresolved. So there are a number of issues that we are working on right now. We are going to contest the ruling, of course, that they could have the permit. That's the first step in the process.
Right. Right.
And I just wanted to say that I'm really glad that you started your comments out by mentioning Flint, because that's been really significant for us. We have been connected to the Flint battles over water from the beginning. We were invited to come and consult in Flint 4 years ago when things first began to develop. We find it totally outrageous that Flint is still in the condition that it's in, and people are getting shut off from their water. And you mentioned the high water bills. They're even higher than you suggested.
Okay.
Some people we know are paying $350 or $400 a month for water that they still can't drink. And at the same time, the water that the city claims is good water now, people are being shut off from that water as well. It's not just that they're not delivering bottled water to people. They're also cutting people off at the tap in the same way that they've been doing in Detroit now for a number of years. We think those issues, Detroit and Flint, are intimately related to what's going on with Ice Mountain.
Absolutely. Absolutely connected. And on another level of connection, I guess, Nestle's spokesperson used to be, I'm not sure if she's still there, but it used to be a woman named Deborah Muchmore, who was the wife of Dennis Muchmore,
yes,
Governor Rick Snyder's chief of staff, who retired and then became a lobbyist. Meanwhile, the Michigan Citizens for Water Conservation, you've been funding yourselves largely with garage sales. I'm just trying to think about the forces opposed here.
Yes. Yeah. Debbie Muchmore's not with the governor, and neither's Dennis. They're not with the governor anymore. They're private lobbyists.
Yeah. He retired and became a lobbyist. Oh, they both are. Okay.
Yeah. And they both are gone. We won't be surprised when the governor, whose term limited, is out of office in November, that he also becomes a lobbyist for a corporation like Nestle. So it won't surprise us if that happens. But We paid off our $1 million debt, as you say, garage sales, bake sales, pasty sales, and the donations of our members over quite a period of time. We are totally a grassroots organization. We have no paid staff. We are all volunteers. So it was definitely a very grassroots effort. What goes on at the state level is just the opposite kind of thing. Before the Flint crisis, the state had cut Flint off of revenue-sharing money that could have been used to fix their infrastructure. They get money taken away from them. Nestle gets profits given to them, you know, in the form of free water. It's just completely unjust.
There is the public process thing, and there's the DEQ, as you mentioned, saying, yes, we did get these public comments that were overwhelmingly opposed to this,
right.
But they implied that not just that those didn't matter, but that they were somehow legally prohibited from caring about this intense public opposition. I don't really understand that.
That's how they read the law, and they read it wrong. There are sections of the law, and we're busy exploring those right now. We do have good legal counsel on our side that do, in fact, require the public comment. So why would you require it if it's irrelevant? You know?
Right. There's not been a tremendous amount of coverage, but those stories that have existed that are deeper will mention that this has been a twisty road for Nestle, and that, in fact, they were initially rejected by the state's water withdrawal assessment tool that said you're going to harm streams, you're going to harm fish. But Nestle appealed that decision, and it's that appeal that is now being approved. So it's not as though, you know, it was always an obvious, you know, there's no environmental impact or no harm here.
Yeah, the water assessment tool, which they got scored a D on it, that's the lowest grade you can get. So they didn't pass that. So they go to the site-specific review, which is not site-specific at all. It's a computer model. It takes place in an office. They never visit the actual site to determine what's really going on there. So, you know, in both cases, you're dealing with computer models. You're not dealing with reality. Whereas we walk out and walk around in the woods and tromp around in the streams and the wetlands and take reporters who are interested to look at the actual site where the streams are dried up, where, you know, Nestle claims that water's pumping at 250 gallons per minute and you're looking at a puddle that's 1 foot wide and there's no water moving in it at all. They were given a lot of expert testimony, legal testimony, extensive, that was submitted as part of those 80,000 comments. They chose to ignore that as well.
Well, I guess it's a question of who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes, you know,
yeah,
because
right.
Nestle's natural resources manager for Michigan says, quote, "We never take out more than nature's bringing back in." Close quote.
Yes, that's probably Arlene, right?
Yes.
Yes, we've gone to their dog and pony shows, is what we call them, where they do their PR work. It's very fancy charts and graphs, and they keep passing the same information out to people all the time. The other issue is that they create 3,000 plastic bottles. I can't remember whether it's in an hour or what.
Right.
So there's the plastic bottle issue as well. Another story.
It's really all sides of it, though, you know, and the connection to Flint, and it all is of a piece, absolutely, you know. And so let me just say, you know, it's not just this story about Flint and its extraction. You know, we can all see these connections, but it's also that people can see that this issue of whether water is a right, of whether corporations can take a vital public resource, because as I said, this is the law of the land, you know?
Yeah.
The law says if you can pump it and extract it, you can get it essentially for free, you know, and sell it at a profit. Well, that's only going to increase. That's only going to come to your state and your community. And yet the lesson seems to be that elected officials are not going to necessarily be on the public side, and it's going to be down to people advocating for themselves. And I guess I would just ask you, what would you say to people who hear that now a company, Nestle or another company, is coming to their community to pump their water out from under them?
Well, one of the things that has to happen is that people have to strengthen the laws that are supposed to be protecting the water. because we do have the public trust doctrine in Michigan, which requires that the state of Michigan protect the water for all of us. And if that were actually honored, they wouldn't be able to come and take it and send it off in bottles elsewhere, and they wouldn't be allowed to destroy the environment. In 2008, however, the state of Michigan weakened its laws a bit. You know, they gave themselves the loophole to send it out as much as they wanted to in small plastic bottles that end up in the Pacific Ocean. There's some pieces of that Safe Drinking Water Act that could be used by the government to protect the water, but they don't choose to use those pieces of the law. So I would tell people, get those laws in place that actually make the government protect the water. Particularly, it's important that the state laws get strengthened and that the people who are paying attention continue to put pressure on the various agencies to do it. Our agencies like the Department of Environmental Quality, at the same time that they're not doing what they should be on this, they're being defunded themselves. So they don't have the resources to do most of the work that they should be doing anyway. And the state legislature is busy trying to pass laws that would take away their right to even regulate anything. They want industry to sit on a board that oversees the regulations of themselves. So there's three bills in our legislature right now that are just horrible. So people need to contest those. They need to talk to their legislators and make sure that they don't let those pass through the legislature unnoticed, that kind of stuff.
And when the company says, oh, you know what, this new permit is going to call for unprecedented levels of monitoring and oversight.
Mm-hmm. And we're glad about that.
Right.
But we're saying that, you know, all these years, Nestle's doing its own monitoring. It's the hen, you know, the fox watching the chicken house. We're saying that that monitoring must be done by an independent agency like the U.S. Geological Survey. We're making that demand. It can't be Nestle monitoring itself.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Peggy Case. She's president of Michigan Citizens for Water Conservation. You can find them and follow their work online at savemywater.org. Peggy Case, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin's produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Today, as the world is being murdered, what are you doing to defend the Earth? That is a question from a recent video by our next guest, deep green thinker Derek Jensen. He is the author of 25 books, including A Language Older Than Words, his 2007 book, As the World Burns, 50 Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial, Resistance Against Empire, and Earth at Risk, Building a Resistance Movement to Save the Planet. Derek Jensen also writes magazine articles, and he appears in videos, including a great series on YouTube. We played a sample from one of Derek's YouTube videos in last week's Radio EcoShock show. From somewhere in Northern California, Derek Jensen, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
It's been a while, since 2007. I guess you've had a few new thoughts since then.
Yeah, it's a while. Things have certainly changed, or things have gotten worse.
They have, and I sort of document that every show. I'd like to go a little bit back towards your roots. Wikipedia tells me that you earned a Bachelor of Science in Mineral Engineering Physics at the Colorado School of Mines. Then you got a Master's in Fine Arts and Creative Writing from Eastern Washington University. That looks like a big life switch. What happened?
Well, I wanted to be a writer ever since I was a kid. And then in high school, I took calculus, and then I did what so many people who take calculus do, which is go into science. And I got a scholarship to the School of Mines, and I couldn't really have afforded to go to school otherwise. And the School of Mines is a really good school. It's one of the top engineering schools in the world. And I didn't really like it very much. But when I was there, I think in my sophomore year, I went to the registrar at the University of Colorado. I was thinking about switching up there and taking English or something, I don't know. And the registrar looked at me and said, "So you have a scholarship to the School of Mines and you want to transfer to the University of Colorado? Are you crazy?" So I continued the School of Mines. I wanted to quit, and my mom said something to me that was one of the smartest things anybody's ever said to me, which is, after my junior year, she said, "Would you rather go the rest of your life saying you have a degree in physics, or would you rather go the rest of your life saying you have 3 years toward a degree in physics?" And I finished it out, and at the same time, I had this sort of habit of asking people if they like their jobs. About 90% said no. So I started asking, what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? And I would ask my fellow students, you know, "Are you enjoying the School of Mines?" And they said, "No, not really." And I said, "Well, are you going to enjoy what you do afterwards?" And they said, "No, not really, but I'll be able to buy a nice car." And I had fellow students who were 20 and 21 and 22 talking about what they're going to do when they retire. And that just seemed crazy to me. So, you know, I'm only going to live this life once, and I wanted to do what I was called to do. So I wanted to be a writer, but still I have to live within this capitalist system. I have to make a living. So I borrowed the money to become a small-scale commercial beekeeper because I figured I could work really hard during part of the year, and then during part of the year I would not be working so hard and I could teach myself how to write. And I did that for several years. It's a very hard way to make a living. I did that for several years, and then I realized I had pretty much taught myself as much as I could teach myself about writing. I had learned as much as I could simply by reading, you know, the greats, and decided it was time to actually go back to school. And then I went and got a master's and enjoyed it. That was probably out of all my years of schooling, that was the only time I really enjoyed school. So that was that transformation.
And you've got a degree in science, and I talk to a lot of top scientists from dozens of specialties here on Radio EcoShock. But in the past, you've had kind of an uneasy relationship with science. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, thanks for bringing that up. And I feel like I've tried to be clear about science, and I feel like I may not have been as clear as I had hoped to be because, well, I guess I want to separate myself from postmodernism. I have a critique of science, and it's a very different critique of science than the sort of postmodern critique, which is that science is just another story, and there's a big war going on right now in academia between sort of social sciences, SIC, and science, where there's a sort of postmodern notion that there is no reality and there's only stories. So when I hear a lot of people make a critique of science, sometimes they're doing that, and that kind of drives me crazy. And my own critique of science is simply that science is one way to know the world. It is not the only way, and And there are assumptions that come with science. I love this line by Robert Coombs, which is, unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. And there are some assumptions that science carries that can influence our relationship. And a great example of that is Richard Dawkins has this great, great line about, and this is pretty close to a direct quote, "Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when." And that's true. So, you know, if you turn on a light switch, then light comes out of the light bulbs, and that's how we know that these processes by which science and engineering have been able to rig up an electrical system for your house, that's why we know that those sort of principles that they're working on are true, because we get results from them. And that's all true. But one of the problems is that if you and I were in the same room and I'm holding a gun and a hoop and I put the gun on you and I point the gun at you and I say, on the count of three, you're going to jump through this hoop or I'm going to shoot you, and then what do you know? On the count of three, you jump through the hoop on command, and I have just made matter and energy jump through hoops on command, and I predicted what would happen and when. I'm a genius. But the problem is that if I do that, that's probably going to destroy any possibility of friendship between us, because I just put a gun on you. And my point in bringing all this up is that so many indigenous people have said that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that the Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, or the world consists of resources to be exploited, as opposed to other beings to enter into a relationship with. And so my critique of science basically boils down to, it's really good for some things. It's really good for developing a system such that, where are you, by the way, physically?
Oh, I'm on the West Coast. I'm just about 5 miles east of Vancouver.
Okay. Vancouver, Washington?
No, Vancouver in Canada.
Okay. So basically, science is great for making it so I can be just 20 miles south of the border of Oregon on the coast of California, and you can be up in Canada, and we can be talking. And it can, you know, these signals can go through the wires, and then you can broadcast them out. Science is really good for doing things like that. Science is not so good for living sustainably in place for 10,000 years. I want to go back to the Richard Dawkins thing, that one of the things he does, he says science bases its claims to truth. Epistemology is how we know something's true. It's a fancy word that just means how we know something is true. And what he's done is he has connected how we know something's true with our ability to dominate it. And that's a really sneaky assumption that has made its way, that permeates a lot of science, that it's really not just about describing things, but it's also about describing things so you can control them. And that basically my entire critique of science boils down to that. But there's a pretty cool thing about science, which is, I mean, about, 25 years now or so, no, 20 years ago, I knew this guy, Cleve Baxter. He's the guy who was famous for attaching a lie detector to a plant, and then when he would think about threatening the plant, it would respond. You know, forget all that. The real point is, he had this great line he said to me, which is, science's ability to measure is going to create a crisis in science, in that it presumes that everyone around us, that the presumption has been that plants don't communicate, et cetera, that plants don't make decisions. But the measuring ability of science is getting to be so great that they will no longer be able to deny that plants, for example, can communicate. And we're running into that right now. It's pretty cool that I wrote about this in my recent book, Myth of Human Supremacy, that if a caterpillar is eating a leaf, then the plant might send out messages to other plants saying, hey, this certain species of caterpillar is eating the leaves. You might want to change the taste of your leaves. You might want to toxify your leaves to protect yourself from this caterpillar or this giraffe or whatever it is. And they communicate through sending out chemical messages. Or a great example of this is, when I lived in Spokane, I had this tree that got a big aphid infestation. And maybe after a couple weeks of that, just hordes of ladybugs showed up and started eating the aphids. And what had happened is, the tree was sending out chemical messages in pheromones that would just waft through the air. And you could either say, hey, there's a party going on here, or you could also say they were dialing 911. You know, it's like, hey, we need some help. Can you come over? Either way, it doesn't matter. The point is, they were sending out messages that were picked up by the ladybugs, and the ladybugs came to then eat the aphids. And there's this guy, Stefano Mancuso, who's been able to develop a dictionary of about 2,500 terms, I believe, 1,500, 2,500 terms, I don't remember, basically different chemical signals that the plants can send to other species and to their own species, to others in their neighborhood. And so my point about that is that science's ability to measure is becoming so great that we are being faced with the understanding that a lot of indigenous people have had forever, which is that everyone is sentient, everyone is thinking, everybody's communicating. So my problem with science is basically just some fundamental assumptions having to do with control.
There are supposedly three currents of environmentalism. There's light green, dark green, and now bright green. What do you think about those categories, and what do you think about me calling you dark green?
Well, I prefer deep green.
Okay.
And I know what bright green is, and I'm going to take a quick stab, like one-sentence stab at light green. If I'm wrong, you can tell me. Light green would be if we just make sort of superficial changes, things will be okay. Is that light green?
I think so. Technological changes.
I thought that was bright green.
I'm confused myself.
Okay, I'm just going to make something up then.
All right.
Okay, here's my understanding, and I could be wrong, and I'm just saying this up front. My understanding of light green would be that if we just pass a couple laws, things will be okay. My understanding of bright green is that through the basically technology will save us, and that if we convert to solar and wind and we do 100% recycling, that things will be okay. And then what I would call deep green and what I guess bright greens would call dark green is the belief that the problems we face are far deeper than simply getting a Democrat in the White House or passing a couple of laws, that the problems are functional and systemic, and that they have to do with how we perceive the world, and they go back to the sort of the core of the culture. That's my thumbnail difference of the three.
This is Radio EcoShock, and after listening to countless climate scientists explain we're heading into doom, it is time to listen to voices from deep green resistance. We're talking with the author and philosopher Derek Jensen. You recently started what I hope will be a series of YouTube videos called Without a Net, and you draw unknown prompts from a cookie jar like an improv for philosophy and social critique. So here's a couple of quick questions from the Radio EcoShock Without a Net jar. Have you ever appeared on mainstream television?
Is democracy now mainstream?
No. I'm thinking the commercial machine, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, anything like that.
I'm trying to be completely honest. I'm trying to think, not in any sort of real way. I probably was, in the background at a baseball game sometime or something.
Yeah.
But no, and effectively, no. And I do have a quick story about that that's kind of funny. Years ago, John Stossel asked me to be on his program, and he was going to fly me to New York. And my mom prohibited me from doing it because Stossel is such a jerk. She said, absolutely not. You know, I won't take care of your animals when you're gone. Don't go. Because I don't know how much your listeners know about John Stossel. He's an anti-environmental. He's just horrible. And one quick thing about Stossel is I talked to his assistant for a couple hours about a week before whether I was or wasn't going to do the show. His big thing was that there are more trees in the country now than there were prior to the beginning of cutting down the trees. And I said, this is ridiculous. That's counting a tiny little tree the same as, you know, a huge old-growth tree. And we're talking about this, and I said, whatever you do, please do one thing, which is do not use white-tailed deer as an example of how clear-cutting helps wildlife, because white-tailed deer like the boundaries between field and forest, as opposed to other species who can only live in deep forests. I said, so please, whatever you do, I don't care what else you do in the program, don't use white-tailed deer as an example, because they're a terrible example, because, of course, white-tailed deer populations are going up. Because, A, there's a lot more edges between forest and clear cuts, and, B, the predators have been killed, so, you know, there aren't the mountain lions and the wolves to take them down. So whatever you do, do not use this as an example. And then you know what he did in this program? He used that as an example of why it's good. So short answer to your question, no, I have not been on mainstream TV.
Okay, next question, Derek Jensen. Why are some people mad at you?
lots of reasons. The interesting thing about that is that I have, over the years, gotten, probably 3,000 or 4,000 pieces of hate mail. And only about 400 or 500 of those are from right-wingers. And the right-wingers mainly came from one thing I said. And the one thing I said that really made the right-wingers mad was that after the Deepwater Horizon spill, I said that the decision-makers, all the way from the top down to the lower-level decision-makers who made that decision to cut safety corners on that, they should all have been tried for murder and killing the, what was it, 8 or 12 workers who died, and also the Gulf of Mexico. And if they were found guilty, they should have been executed. And I wasn't saying we should lynch them. I was actually saying we should go through process. There's precedents for this, too, by the way. The Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, Bhopal, he was tried in absentia in India and sentenced to hang, and then the United States wouldn't extradite him. Anyway, so I suggested that, and the right wing just went apoplectic. And I got bazillions of death threats, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that. But the main reason I've gotten the hate mail over the years has been, it's been from vegans because I eat meat. It's been from anti-car activists because I drive a car. It's been from people because I have a bank account, because I get paid when I do university events. And really what it boils down to is the notion that lifestyle change is sufficient for social change, as opposed to believing in organized political, including militant, when appropriate, resistance. And so it really, the distinction has boiled down to those who believe that lifestyle changes are sufficient have sent me just boatloads of hate mail over the years. And that continues to this day. And we can talk more about the why some people don't like me if you want, but that's my short answer.
Good enough. Well, I've just got one left in the cookie jar here, and it's, what do you think about the Green Party and its leader in the last American election, Jill Stein?
You're going to hear something from a male you don't often hear, which is, I don't know much about her, and so I'm not going to give an opinion. Usually, since I'm a guy, I go ahead and give an opinion to any question I'm asked. But I will say about the Greens that I see them as a decent... So is that heavy sigh? Is that a good enough answer? I think that we desperately need to break the stranglehold of the two-party, one-party system in the United States. So they do present a bit better of an alternative on that, but they don't nearly go far enough for me, and they also can sort of fall into some liberal silliness sometimes. When I have voted in American elections, in U.S. elections, I voted for Greens for a while. I voted for Nader. So I do that because I can't bring myself to... You know, we can talk about whether, you know, the point of voting, but I can't bring myself to vote for a Democrat. And so I have done them or the Peace and Freedom Party and some of the other small parties. I do think that we do need some robust shifting of the political spectrum. You know, I really like what Gail Dine says about the left in the United States, that the left is, if you define any sort of reasonable left as being at base anti-capitalist, there is no left in the United States. And so it's nice to have someone at least trying to push that a little bit. I wish they had more stronger teeth.
More radical.
Yeah.
You know, I've tuned into your work since the early 2000s, and you were speaking out really early, I thought, on violence and abuse of women. And now we have the Me Too movement. What do you take from this rebirth of women's emergence from the violence of patriarchy?
I think it's great. I mean, I think it's great that women are speaking out, and I think it's great that it is gaining some traction, and I think it's great that there are at least some men who are facing consequences for their abusive behavior. One of the things that I find really interesting to watch, or really interesting to read about through history, is how societies change and how quite often you can have movement towards something getting better, but the underlying hatred that caused the original atrocity will find another way to manifest. And one really great example of that is after chattel slavery ended, well, race-based chattel slavery more or less ended after the American Civil War, then it only took about 10 years or less for some of the early Jim Crow laws to start getting passed, and for the, you know, deprived with the Southern whites deprived of their right to steal. feel the labor and lives of people of African descent, it didn't take long to come up with, for example, vagrancy laws, where now they could simply arrest somebody and then send them to prison and get their labor once again. And so then after that, we get the sort of prison industrial complex. So something that I find really both fascinating and horrifying to watch is to see how there will be these great strides made and then the backlash against them, and how the backlash will sort of change form so that no longer is it chattel slavery, but now it's vagrancy slavery, or it's, you know, some other, you know, cussing on Sunday slavery or something, and how the underlying imperative to enslave in this case ends up getting still manifested. And so I see that, you know, that there's great movement being made with women having the courage to come forward and tell their stories. Just today, I was looking at the ESPN website, and the MMA fighter Paige VanZant is saying that she was sexually assaulted when she was a teenager, and she's having the courage to come out and talk about this. So I think it's really great that there is a forum for this happening. That part's wonderful. And then at the same time, we're seeing, you know, like pornography is becoming more and more open and part of the culture. And we're seeing a lot of, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's not so simple as all the water flowing in one direction, like a great river moving toward a sea of liberation, which is just the world's worst metaphor, but that's fine. It's not all that. There are eddies and currents that and countercurrents. And so it's a good thing, but there are also various backlashes that also need to be attended to. And we see this with environmental stuff. We see this. I don't know if I'm anticipating another question here, but I'll just mention this. You can either go with it or not. That you know, environmentalism made some really great strides, but over the last 30 years, there's been this transformation of environmentalism from being about protecting wild places and wild beings and toward attempting to sustain this culture that is actually causing the problems in the first place. And there's been sort of a neoliberal takeover of environmentalism, and also a takeover to make it not only about sustaining, like there's this line by the head scientist for the Nature Conservancy where he talks about how we need to not protect biodiversity for its own sake, but conservation or environmentalism needs to be measured by how well it serves humans. And that's quite an extraordinary statement. It's a very, very long way of answering your question. I think it's great that women are speaking out, and I think that there will be backlashes and countercurrents, and to go to a cliche, the struggle continues.
Well, I would offer you this story from Edmund O. Wilson, the great biologist, and he said that when ants decide to change their nests, that a whole bunch of the ants start carrying the eggs away towards the new nest, but then other ants come along from the same group and say, oh no, what are you doing? Put everything back in the hole. And so you can have like a flow of ants going one way and then a smaller flow going the other way, carrying the eggs back. And they only move the nests when the last of the ants going backwards give up, and now you've got a new nest.
Well, I love that, and thank you. Also, I just wanted to stop for a second and acknowledge that your questions are great, so thank you. And then the thing with the ants, and that reminds me of what, I never can remember who this was, Max Planck maybe? It was somebody or another who said that the way scientific debates are usually resolved are not because one side convinces the other, but because the people who believe one of the models dies out of old age. You know, you get one model for how life works or how the atom works, and then you get this other competing model, and nobody ever convinces anybody, but, you know, one side just grows old.
I'm hoping that will happen with climate change denial, that generation of, it's mostly old guys, but old people die off, and the young people coming out of the colleges who are seeing it happen right around them just don't have any time for it and demand some climate action.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm talking with the voice of Deep Green Resistance, Derek Jensen, a voice, I should say, really. And it's great to be talking with you too, Derek. I mean, if my questions are any good, it's because I've been following your work and learning from you. And you have said that the industrial civilization must fall. Are you sticking with that? And would that be a good thing, really?
Yes, I'm sticking with that. And would that be a good thing? Let's put an asterisk on would that be a good thing and come back to that. And my memory is not what it used to be. So if I forget, please don't hesitate to remind me. So far as it having to come down, I wrote A Language Old in Words, and really one of the points of that is how this culture is sort of psychologically irredeemable. And then I wrote Culture and Make-Believe, and I approached it from a sociological perspective, that sort of with the system of social rewards that we have will lead to atrocity. And then when I started to write Endgame, it's like, how do I approach this question of sustainability from a different perspective? And partly I was getting at, if, you know, you can argue psychology, you can argue sociology, but you can't really argue resource movement. And what I mean by all this is that civilization can be defined as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. Now, it's defensible both linguistically and historically. And that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? So a city I defined as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And a couple things happen when you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable. And what I mean by that is if you require the importation of resources, that means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, and as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area. I mean, think about New York City. Where does the city get its wood? Where does it get the materials for brick? Where does it get the materials for asphalt? Where does it get the materials for... Where does the poop go? Where does the other garbage go? Where does it get its water? And cities have, from the beginning, required a countryside from which they can harvest, from which they can take. And as your city grows, you will be taking from an ever larger area. And I contrast cities with, say, camps or villages that don't require the importation of resources, that the Talawa, on whose land I now live, they lived here for at least 12,500 years. They've been carbon dated to that long. And when the dominant culture arrived here 180 years ago, the place was a paradise in terms of food. I mean, they ate salmon, and then they ate some salmon, and then they also ate elk, and they ate shellfish, and they ate some marine mammals, huckleberries, and a lot of salmon. And the salmon were still here in huge numbers when the dominant culture arrived. And my point is that they were living within what the land could supply. And, you know, people oftentimes like to say, you know, Indians affected their land base too. But here's the difference, is that they were planning on living in place for the next 500 years. And if you're planning on living in place for the next 500 years, your land use decisions will be different. I'm not saying the Talawa were perfect. I'm not saying, you know, they were sort of noble savages who nobody ever got mad at each other and nobody ever did anything bad. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is they lasted here for 12,500 years without destroying the place. That's all I'm saying at this moment. And they did that without requiring the importation of resources. They, once again, lived with what the land gave willingly. And here's a really important thing to think about is, you know, I love reading old, and also breaks my heart, to read what places were like prior to conquest. You know, you can read accounts of so many passenger pigeons that they darkened the sky for days at a time, and you read accounts of whales that they're so thick that they're a hazard to shipping. I'm not making this up. And you read accounts of fish that are so thick that they slow down your boat. And I did a talk in San Francisco a few years ago, and before I did the talk, I looked up what San Francisco, the bay, was like prior to conquest. And the early Spanish explorers described so many sea lions that it looked like the entire bay was paved with them. And there'd be troops of grizzly bears. You know, where I live right now, I see bears every day. I haven't seen them today, but saw them yesterday. I'll see them later today, probably. I see black bears. This time of year, usually a mother and baby, a mother and yearling. And I get all excited about that until I remember what I read a while ago, that if you live near a river, and I live right near a stream, if you live near a river, you would see a grizzly bear in Northern California every 15 minutes. So I love reading the accounts of what life was like and what the world was like. And the important thing here is for us to ask, how did life get to be so fecund in the first place? How did these places get to be so rich with life? And the way they got to be so rich with life is by every creature making the world a better place by its birth and death. That's how it has to happen. That's the only way it can happen, is salmon make the forest a better place by being spawned or by being born, you know, by coming into existence and then by coming up and dying.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
But we are actually less than a century away from disaster.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with Derek Jensen.
We have this idea. This is one of those crazy assumptions that unquestioned assumptions that guides the culture. We have this idea that evolution is based on competition. It's based on survival of the fittest, the meanest, the most capitalist. It's based on whoever can exploit their surroundings the best. And that's not how life works. That those creatures who survive in the long run have survived in the long run. And the way you survive in the long run is by improving your habitat. And so you don't do that by denuding the landscape of whatever resource it is you're denuding. And the other thing that happens as soon as you require the importation of resources is your way of life has to be based on violence. Because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if the people in the next watershed over won't trade you for it, and you need it, you're going to take it. So here's an example of that, is that I was getting interviewed several years ago by this guy from Nature Online, and he was a dedicated Marxist who believed that it was possible to have an industrial society with only voluntary exchanges, with no coercion whatsoever. And I said, great, do you have cities? He said, yes. I said, so how do you get around in your city? He said, by bus. I said, what's your bus made of? He said, by mines, or they're made from minerals. I said, okay, so how do you get people to go in mines? He said, well, you just pay them a lot. I said, well, you know, mining is really such a horrible existence that it was one of the first forms of slavery, but I will give you that one. You can just pay them a ton, whatever. But we know that mines create pollution. They do this by definition. You can't avoid it. And they pollute water. And so what do you do about the people who live next to the river? He said, well, you pay them to move. I said, what if they've been living there for 5,000 years and they don't want to move? Their ancestors are there. He said, you pay them more. I said, they're not going to move because they will not leave their ancestors. He said, well, how many of them are there? I said, I don't know, 400. What difference does it make? He said, well, the million people in the city vote, and they vote that the 400 people near the river have to move, and so you kick them out. I said, so what you're saying is that you have moved within less than a minute from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, land theft, and genocide against indigenous people all within a minute just so you can have a bust. And my point is that for us to think about industrial civilization not being sustainable, what we have to do is just follow back the supply chains for the various materials we have. So where did they get the plastics, and what are the processes involved to bring the plastics together for this telephone that I'm holding in my hand? And where do we get the copper for the wiring in your house? Where do we get all of these materials? Have to come from somewhere. They don't just appear out of nowhere. And what do we leave behind? You know, one of my books was called What Do We Leave Behind? Or What We Leave Behind? And it's that book is really following the same question, except what happens to the stuff we dump that at one point, not even very long ago, all of our trash was food for someone else. If I eat an apple and I throw the core out, the core is going to be gone tomorrow because a possum's going to eat it, or slugs are going to eat it, apple, or bears going to eat it, somebody's going to eat it. And when I poop, slugs eat that, bacteria eat it, plants eat it. But now we've created, for example, with plastics were created intentionally because they wanted to make something that wouldn't decay. And another word for decay is another phrase for decay is somebody eating it. And we have, this culture has intentionally created stuff that no one has ever eaten. And obviously that causes problems because that has broken the nutrient chain upon which all of life is based. And I want to say one more thing, and then I'll just shut up about this, that it's a tiny little thing I've been doing for the past year that I just think is so fun, which is I read somewhere that mealworms can eat styrofoam. They have bacteria in their guts who can digest, who can break the chemical bonds of styrofoam and turn it into nutrients. And I had raised mealworms when I was a kid, and so I bought some mealworms online, and what do you know, they're eating styrofoam. It's pretty cool. And I just harvested my first mealworm poop not very long ago. I've got like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 15 large shoebox things full of mealworms and styrofoam, and then also I feed them some greens. Anyway, I harvested the first mealworm poop, and I put it on my houseplants. And the cool thing is that fungus is growing all over the mealworm poop. And what that means is that the styrofoam bonds have been broken, because if I just put styrofoam on top of it, the fungus wouldn't be able to eat it. So basically, in this case, I haven't been able to do it. The mealworms have been able to bring some styrofoam back into the nutrient chain. That makes me very happy. But that's not the answer to the larger question. Back to the larger question. Yeah, this whole way of life is inherently unsustainable.
All right, but there is that daydream out there, and it goes like this. The world's richest people will realize the planet is in trouble and organize amongst themselves to save us. Will the billionaires save us?
No. Part of the reason we can say that is, who is us is one question, and that's not a rhetorical question. Who is us? When you say, will they'll save us?
Well, yeah. The people who work for them, I guess, or the people who live in the countries they used to inhabit, or, good question.
It's certainly not Pacific lampreys, and it's not pipistrelle bats. The mainstream climate activists, one of the things I talk about often is that all the so-called solutions to global warming that we see presented by the mainstream, what they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is having to conform to industrial capitalism. And that's insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because the real world has to be primary, because without a real world, you don't have any social system whatsoever. So the real world has to be, the natural world has to be more important than any social system. You know, I can condense all of my work down to one basic premise, which is this culture is not sustainable. It will end at some point. And when it ends, I want for there to be as much life as possible on this planet. That's it. We've just condensed 25 books down to, two sentences, three sentences, however many. So when we see a lot of these billionaires, what they're attempting to do is attempting to maintain this culture just a little bit longer. They're not doing this for the natural world. I mean, for crying out loud, you have, Elon Musk is one of the reasons he's pushing this whole thing for Mars is because he thinks that, basically the Earth is doomed. And that seems a pretty evident statement of his lack of concern for the effects of this culture on the natural world. And, okay, I'm going to back off from what I just said. When we just said rich people are not going to save us, I'm thinking of people like him or Zuckerberg or any of these other people who, for the most part, are human supremacists and don't care about the natural world. But I had this interesting thing happen a year ago that was really cool. It's that I was invited to participate in the annual board meeting of the company Patagonia. You know, Patagonia has funded good parts, by which I don't mean like solar cells. I mean they've funded protecting land. They've funded good parts of the environmental movement for the last 25 years. They've done wonderful work between Yvonne Chouinard and Doug and Chris Tompkins. It's fabulous work. And I went to to their board meeting, wasn't really sure what to expect, because they're like $500 million company, $700 million company. They're a big company, not huge, but big. And it was really wonderful that it was cool talking to people who understood what I was saying earlier about the chain of supply stuff. They'll understand that even though they're making this eco-groovy stuff, that's not sufficient, that they're still killing the planet. And they are attempting to do really good work by protecting land. And I think that that is one of the most important things that rich people can do, is attempt to protect as much of the natural world as possible. And when I say natural world, that includes traditional indigenous people living there. It does not include mining. It doesn't include logging. But it does include people living subsistence lives there. I mean, the question is, does this person, here's the real question for this rich person, this theoretical rich person, do they want to keep the bauxite in the mountain? Or do they want to pull the bauxite out and make it into aluminum? And if they want to pull the bauxite out and make it into aluminum, then they're not helping the planet.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with Derek Jensen. As you know, Derek, the greatest show on earth is now carried on cable TV. It's in the newspapers like New York Times, The Washington Post. Who can compete with the spectacle of the Donald Trump unreality show, it's hard to look away, even for me. Is the American government actually collapsing? And can the economy be far behind?
So given your questions, I'm just annoyed that I haven't been on here in 10 years. These are great questions. Thank you. And, you know, A, it is a spectacle. It's quite extraordinary. I was at my mom's a little while ago, and we were watching that spectacle, and we were also watching the spectacle just today of Zuckerberg testifying before Congress or before the Senate. And, you know, it is quite striking political theater. And I keep thinking about a couple things. One is that I remember the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings back when I was 30 or something, and fairly newly politicized. And I was kind of chewing my nails as to whether Clarence Thomas was going to get confirmed. And then, of course, he did get confirmed. And I realized that a lot of the stuff that we see is exactly what you just said. It's a show. And it's a reality show just like any other, and it's scripted just like any other. I don't mean like in a conspiracy theory sense. I mean that I love what my friend George Raffin says about how you don't have to have a conspiracy when everybody thinks the same. When everybody is a booster of capitalism, you know, you're going to have one thing. And then I think also about sort of the collapse of Rome and the slow collapse over, what, 1,000 years? And I think about, which ours is not going to last that long, but, you know, we're increasingly having, I mean, like, Donald Trump's kind of a buffoon. And he reminds me of some of the buffoonish emperors in Rome. And we are getting a good show as the world burns, you know? And is the American economy or is the American government collapsing? Oh, I never answered the question you asked a minute ago. I want to go back to the asterisk. Remember the one about is it a good thing?
Yeah, is it a good thing if the industrial civilization collapses?
Depends on your perspective. From my individual physical perspective, I have Crohn's disease and also some other health conditions, and I'll be dead in 6 months. So from that perspective, no. But from the perspective, but my life is not more important than the health of the planet. From the perspective of coho salmon, they want it down. From the perspective of prairie dogs, they want it down. From the perspective of traditional indigenous people still living on their land, they want it down. You know, I asked years ago. I asked Anuradha Mittal and then also Vandana Shiva if the poor people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow, and they both said yes, of course. And there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe, and there are people starving to death because of the global economy all over the world. There are, of course, you know, farmers who were driven off their land, subsistence farmers in Mexico driven off their land by NAFTA. And the poor people, the very poor the world over, if the grid collapsed, they would not be harmed at all because they don't have access to electricity in the first place. And what they do have is people from Europe stealing their land. And I asked Vandana Shiva about the people, the poor people in Mumbai, for example. Would they be better off or would they just starve to death? And she said, no, they'd be better off too because the people in the slums of Mumbai are not there because they want to be. They're there because they were forced off their land. And if you have the land that is now used for cash crops, for tea, for export, if you have that land, if the people who stole that land no longer have the support of a government, they will immediately go back to their subsistence farming. So for even the poor, this would be a good thing. For those of us who have access to the Donald Trump show and who have access to ESPN 24 hours a day, we will lose our comforts or elegancies. But that's what happens when you have a way of life that's based on, I mean, that's the thing, is it's all a zero-sum game. Our comforts or elegancies come from somewhere else. And the only reason we don't see all this violence is because we're living behind a gated community, and the gated community is guarded by the U.S. military. The U.S. military doesn't exist just for the heck of it. It exists to make access to resources possible. Anyway, so now back to the Donald Trump show. You know, I've been having one of my sisters is very, very far right wing, and she and I both thought that Obama was going to be the last president of the United States back when he was elected. She, because she's very right wing, and she thought that he was going to have a coup and he was going to then, you know, institute a liberal, you know, left wing government that would last forever. And me, because because the economy of 2008 really, the collapse of the economy in 2008, I thought it was going to be sort of make cascading system failure. And we were both wrong. I think that the collapse is going to be slower than either my sister or I had anticipated. And once again, my sister and I are looking at this collapse from entirely different perspectives. I don't think that Donald Trump is the end. You know, like I said, the Roman Empire was able to limp along for quite a long while, and this one won't be able to limp along for as long because the global economy is, because resource extraction has made it so the natural world is collapsing much more quickly, and also because the interconnectedness of the global economy makes it so, you know, in the ancient Roman Empire, you could have partial collapses. You could have a collapse here, but because it was not so interdependent, you could not have the collapse elsewhere. But when we require coltan from the Democratic Republic of Congo, the economy is increasingly top-heavy and is increasingly reliant on... It's like, you know, people talk about having a so-called renewable economy, but I was interviewing Alice Friedman about that, who has written about diesel trucks especially. And basically, diesel is incredibly energy dense. You have a lot more energy stored per unit, per mass. And so you can have a semi-truck that can have a payload of 60,000 pounds with a fuel load of, I don't know, 500 pounds or something, and it can go 500 miles. I could be off. Maybe the fuel weighs 100 pounds. I don't know how much the fuel weighs, but it doesn't weigh that much. And if you were to do this with batteries, you would have to have, for the same range, you would have to have a 55,000-pound battery for a total 60,000-pound payload, which only leaves you 5,000 pounds for transportation. So they can have these trucks for locally, the electric trucks for locally, like for UPS, but you can't have them for long haul. And my point is that the entire economy is dependent on that. The entire economy, everything you see right now, I don't remember her numbers, but it was basically like everything you see has been on 10 different trucks or 7 different trucks or a huge number of trucks. And so my point is that the economy is really dependent upon that sort of, on the global transportation system, which is based on oil, and oil is a uniquely dense source of energy. And so, yeah, I think it's all going to come down. It'll come down in fits and starts, and we will definitely see it, but I don't know when.
I was watching a recent video called Undercutting Assumptions that you did, and you were talking about the cultural bedrock idea of land ownership. And I'm thinking about it, and I wondered how we would carry some of your reconceptions through such a crash. And I thought, well, maybe your work is really waiting for an audience in the future.
Well, thanks for saying that. And, you know, sometimes I feel like that I'm writing... It won't do any good at that point, but I am writing for somebody to go, gosh, he was right. But what I'm really trying to do is, okay, I got really excited during Arab Spring because I was so excited with all these people demonstrating for democracy. And a friend of mine pointed out that there's a difference between mobilizing and organizing. And mobilizing you can do short-term. Organizing takes longer to do. And we saw that in Arab Spring, where the winners of the first round were really the sort of pro-democracy forces who basically mobilized through Facebook or through social media or through, you know, sort of superficial means, using superficial and value-neutral sense here. But the winners of the second round were, in Egypt, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood. And one reason is because they were more highly organized. They've been organizing for 80 years. And then the winners of the third round, of course, was the U.S.-backed military because they'd been organizing even longer and had even more resources. And my point is that organizing takes time, and changing culture takes time. And you can't, you know, I read this line years ago where this one guy said it takes 10 years to change your mind. And for me, that sometimes is true, and sometimes it's only a couple years. I know when I first read John Livingston saying that he believes evolution is primarily based on cooperation, not competition, I was thinking, man, this guy's crazy. And then it was like 3 or 4 years later, with no discernible transition, I was finding myself unable to conceptualize the notion that evolution could be based exclusively on competition. It just didn't work for me anymore. And that took 3 or 4 years. So in many ways, that's what my work is trying to do, is lay the groundwork for other people to be able to pick it up and take it further. And that takes time, and that's one of the problems we have, is you don't really have time. There are 200 species went extinct today, and 200 species go extinct tomorrow. We don't have a lot of time, which is one reason I write so many books, is because I'm desperate, and I'm trying to do this. I'm trying to move these shift the culture as fast as I can. And another thing that's very hard to think about, but is also true, is Peggy Reeve Sanday talked about. She studied why some cultures have high rates of rape and some cultures have low rates of rape, and she found that there are characteristics that can mark certain high rape cultures, and some are what we'd expect. If women are treated poorly generally, it's probably a high rape culture. If they're highly militarized, it's probably a high rape culture. Those are all what we'd expect. But there was one that I found really interesting, which is if there's a history of ecological dislocation in the last 300 to 400 years, and that says two things to me. One of them is that when patriarchal civic society collapses, or when societies collapse, or when they undergo trauma, sometimes men take it out on women. And we see this, for example, you know, when a mill closes, then oftentimes rates of domestic violence go up. We see this. I'm not saying it's okay. I'm not saying, oh, this explains it. What I'm saying is that's a marker. We should recognize that sort of correlation. And one of the reasons we should recognize is because no matter for what reason, this culture is going to collapse. And when it collapses, men's violence against women is going to increase. And as it collapses, white entitlement will also come to the fore. That's one of the things I'm really proud of with the culture of make-believe is I pretty much predicted the sort of rise of the Tea Party and now alt-right stuff, in that what we see is that when there are economic hardship, oftentimes those who have been at the top of the heap will, instead of blaming capitalism for their woes, they will blame new immigrants. They will blame Jews, in the case of Germany. They will blame African-Americans or Mexican-Americans, in the case of white people in this country. And you see this pretty predictably. And so my point is, one of the reasons I write is because I want to help inoculate us as much as possible from the harmful effects of that crash that is going to come, no matter that is in process and will continue. And so if you can recognize before the crash comes that as crashes come, men's violence against women increases, you may be able to diminish or to stop at least some of that violence against women. And so that's one of the reasons that I write as I do. You know, I love the book Lord Jim, and in this book, it's a novel by Joseph Conrad, and in this book, this very honorable character is faced with a terrible decision. He's a crew member on a ship that they think is sinking, and you know the crew is supposed to go down with the ship, but he is a coward in the moment, and he makes the wrong decision, jumps off the ship into a lifeboat, and then he spends the rest of his life making up for that terrible decision. That's not a spoiler. That happens early in the book. And the point is that we can all make terrible decisions in the moment. This is why athletes train. This is why people do martial arts, is because you want to have it be muscle memory so that when the crisis comes, you act in a proper way. And one of the things I'm trying to do with my writing is to think through these issues in a calm time when we have the luxury to think about them and to have these conversations, so that as things become increasingly chaotic, it can be a part of our muscle and body memory that we should act in a different fashion. Does that make sense?
It does, but sadly, I have to say, we're running out of time for this show and maybe for Action to Save What Is Left. So, Derek Jensen, how do people find you on the net?
At www.derekjensen.org, DerekJensen.org, and my book should be available in libraries and bookstores, insofar as bookstores still exist.
You've got tons of great books, and I was going to ask you what would be the book you would recommend to the first-time Derek Jensen reader.
You know, maybe A Language Older Than Words, or maybe Myth of Human Supremacy.
From America's West Coast, we've been speaking with the author of 25 books to choose from, and he's a leading figure in the Deep Green Resistance, Derek Jensen, and I'll put links to some of Derek's work and his contact points in my own Radio EcoShock blog, published Wednesdays, at ecoshock.org. And as he says, you can go directly to derekjensen.org. Derek, thank you for hanging out with us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, gosh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, doing what I do. It is eerie when a description of a past age seems to explain what we will be facing as the climate shifts this century. Around 4,270 years ago, the grasslands of Egypt disappeared, leaving a vast desert. Archaeologists claim to have discovered a regional climate shift during a time of written records and great buildings like the pyramids. Here is a short clip from a film, Egypt, The End of the Age of Pyramids, part of a Twilight of Civilizations series produced by Art France. I found it uploaded to YouTube. I went for the history, but heard it as a documentary of our future.
An ibex. Further away, we can see two oryx and a prowling lion. What does this mean? It shows that the pyramids were not in a desert environment as they are now. There was savanna here, African savanna, and a huge variety of wild animals. The climate changed. The wildlife disappeared.
In the century leading up to the revolution, the savanna gave way to desert. And the animals needing the most water disappeared from the kingdom. Where's the proof? Audrin Labrousse believes he found it when studying the texts in Pepe I's funerary chamber.
There's an important clue here. This elephant. This animal is not at all realistic. It's obvious that the Egyptians were no longer familiar with this animal. They had probably kept a sketchy model on a papyrus. They knew that it had to have trunk and tusks. But there was nothing realistic about this animal anymore. And yet we know that the Egyptians were masters of realism. This is simply an idea of an elephant, of something that had not existed in Egypt for a very long time. So here we have absolute proof of climate change.
The elephant was probably the first to disappear, before the lion or the giraffe, which was still part of the landscape. But the question remains, when did this climate change occur exactly? A few kilometers away, a team from the German Archaeological Institute may have found the answer. These scientists are excavating the causeway of King Snefru, Khufu's father. On studying the mud bricks used to make the causeway, they realized it had been restored 300 years after its construction, during the reign of Pepe I. That's to say, at the time climate change is thought to have occurred. This causeway, which led to the pharaoh's famous pyramid, was originally open to the elements. It was later turned into a long-roofed corridor.
That was a description of regional climate change in Egypt from the film Egypt, The Age of the Pyramids. Thousands of our great buildings will not go underneath blowing sand, but under the rising seas and great storm surges. As in ancient times, animals and plants will also disappear, but this time around the world. Please tell others that climate change is a real danger beyond imagination, but tracked by science. Become a climate activist, a part-time activist, or at least a person brave enough to speak out and tell everyone. I'm Alex Smith. Join me once again as we wrestle with the dragon on Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
In a way or another, every Palestinian gathering there was a target.
Gaza specifically is still bleeding from everything that it had been through.
Discrimination is only addressed by universities once it's actually challenged by people.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Away from the fence. As you see, we can see the Israeli army snipers, we can see the Israeli army soldiers in the jeeps and trying to target all the protesters that are being very close to the fence by live ammunition, rubber bullets, and the tear gas canisters. They are using new, updated, and developed weapons. As you see, this is the tear gas by the drone, by the Israeli army. They are using the drone to throw the tear gas canisters on the protesters. And this is like the 10th time they're using it since.
Rifat, your thoughts on this past week in Gaza and the next 6 weeks of protests?
Like I said, this is unprecedented in many ways, because Rawan has just said that it's bringing people together, it's uniting people, it's reviving, sparking the hope that people have. We know that sooner or later Israel will be defeated, but every now and then we need something to boost the morale, and this nothing does this like Palestinians of all the political spectrum, of all ages, of all social ranks, gathering together, sitting next to each other, talking about one thing, about return, about the possibility of this march changing something. Maybe, like I said, it might not change things, not because Palestinians are losers, but because Israel is brutal. Israel is backed by America, by the European Union, by even the Arab regimes nowadays, and Israel has never been this powerful and this arrogant. But again, this will help revive the spark, the hope that Rawan has just mentioned, that Palestinians have the right to return, have have everything to cling to, hope their future, the future generations. So this is significant, and again, it exposes Israel as a brutal colonial power, that no matter what Palestinians do, Israel will kill them. No matter what resistance, method of resistance we will use, Israel will still brutalize us, demonize us. Israel will be racist. Israel will be Israel. And this is very clear, not even today. In the West Bank, we see almost on weekly basis the peaceful, nonviolent protests in Nalin and Berlin. And we see how Israel brutalizes and kills and shoots the protesters. We see how Israel bans BDS activists who call for, you know, the human, the equal rights of Palestinians and the right to return and these things. So these Palestinians were unarmed, were peacefully protesting, and it's special because even the people who died, Israel tried to demonize this march because of Hamas. But Israel, yes, Israel hates Hamas, but Israel hates Palestinians. Like I said, if Palestinians shoot rockets, fire rockets, or carry guns, Israel will destroy them and will criminalize and demonize them. If Palestinians carry stones and Molotov cocktails, if Palestinians fly kites, if Palestinians breathe, Israel will hate them, and Israel will want to them to be submitting and kneeling, and abjectly kneeling. So the fact that some of those killed by Israel turned out to be Hamas militants It doesn't mean that this is a military march. It doesn't mean that Hamas is behind this. It means something else. It means that those people who belong to these military wings, those people who have guns, who are trained to shoot and maybe to snipe, chose to leave their guns behind, to be among their families and friends, to be among the unarmed, peaceful protesters, to be out there, again, unarmed. And when these people choose this, it means something important is changing in the Palestinian community. I'm not saying this to demonize the armed Palestinian resistance. The armed Palestinian resistance is legitimate. It's moral. It's something Palestinians have to do sometimes to defend their very existence. But it's very significant to look at those people who are well-trained, militarily speaking. And again, we see them unarmed participating and being shot by Israel. It means, again, they have chosen this path. They're trying to see what other scenarios, what other means of resistance they can be involved in. This is not a military march. We will keep saying this. Palestinians insist on this. And there were many people posted videos of Israeli soldiers on the borders. If Palestinians, if some of these militants wanted to shoot these Israeli soldiers, they were sitting ducks, but they chose not to do so. Because, again, I have to repeat this so many times, because this is a nonviolent, peaceful march. And again, not for food, because we're not asking for food, we're not asking for aid, we're asking for our freedom, the end of the Israeli occupation. It might sound far-fetched, but it sounded far-fetched for some South African, the end of apartheid in South Africa sounded far-fetched for so many people. But again, we don't know what comes. We will keep struggling. We will keep fighting. And people are coming together more than ever before. And like I said, they're trying to see if this nonviolent protest this time bring something new, or if the world is going also to overlook the Palestinian blood, be silent, and actually give Israel the green line, like we have said. So this is significant. This is unprecedented, not in the sense that peaceful protests are new to Palestinian struggle. No, Palestinians have been engaged in this kind of struggle for seven decades, even before the Israeli, the establishment of Israel. But this time, everyone is coming out together, Fatah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front. Everybody is demanding the right of return. And this is very significant.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. That's the voice of Rifat Alarir, and also we heard from Rowan Yagi. They're both in Gaza. They're both writers and scholars. And we thank you both so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast, and look forward to your contributions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you.
ودفء القلب أعطيكم
وأهديكم ضياع عيني ودفء القلب أعطيكم
فمأساتي التي أحيا نصيبي من مآسيكم
وأهديكم ضياع عيني ودفء القلب أعطيكم
فمأساتي التي أحيا نصيبي من مآسيكم
أناديكم أشد على
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. We'll be talking about a new academic boycott campaign being launched by scholars and academics on U.S. campuses who are calling for universities to abolish the study abroad in Israel programs. According to the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, or USACBI, these programs, quote, are on their face discriminatory due to Israeli restrictions on freedom of movement based on national origin, religion, and ethnic identity, not to mention recent laws passed that would ban entry to faculty or students based on constitutionally protected political opinions, and therefore in violation of university anti-discrimination and equal opportunity policies. Joining us to talk about this campaign is David Lloyd, professor of English at UC Riverside and a member of the organizing collective of USACBI, the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. David, it's so good to have you back with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Nora. It was great to be back on.
So if you could, it would be great to have you lay out the breadth of these study abroad in Israel programs. How many campuses, you know, are taking part? What kind of a program is this, really?
Nora, we actually don't know the exact numbers now. We're doing our research into this. The difficulty of establishing that is that in general, some universities, particularly larger universities, will run their own study abroad programs. Others will collaborate with study abroad programs being run either by, you know, outside agencies or by other universities, which allow students from their sister universities to participate. So it's a bit unclear, A, how many study abroad programs there are, and secondly, how many students would participate in them from all of the universities around the United States. We are aware, for example, that NYU has a program, and there is an ongoing campaign to have that program be investigated on the grounds of probable discrimination against certain students at NYU. You've mentioned some of the grounds, and we could go further on that if you wish.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the inherent problems in the study abroad in Israel scheme. As you laid out, as USACBI laid out, they are discriminatory because, of course, it would be nearly impossible for a Palestinian-American student to participate because of Israel's racist entry policies. Lay this out a bit and how Israel's policies violate these basic university non-discrimination rules in these programs.
Well, let me start by citing no less an authority than the U.S. State Department. At this point, I want your listeners to listen up, because it seems to me very probable that this sentence will be removed from the U.S. State Department's page of travel advisories to travelers who would be going to Israel as soon as our campaign launches. Because it's very probable that as soon as it's seen that the information I'm about to give is a very official statement of Israel's discriminatory entry policies, it will be removed. So listen up. What the U.S. State Department page, which is on its site where there are advisories to travelers going to any part of the world, so for any country that might cause problems for U.S. travelers of any kind, whether it's being in a state of civil war, or whether it's regular discrimination, or whether it's a history of denying visas to U.S. citizens, or anything like that, the U.S. State Department will post a travel advisory. Now, what it openly observes on the sites relating to Israel is the following. U.S. citizens whom Israeli authorities suspect of being Arab, Middle Eastern, or of Muslim origin may face additional, often time-consuming and probing questioning by immigration and border authorities, or may even be denied entry into Israel, the West Bank, or Gaza. Now, it's well known by anybody who is of Palestinian descent, for example, or who has an Arab name, or who is noticeably Muslim, or even not even noticeably Muslim, that it is very likely that they will at the very least be held up and questioned on entry into Israel, whether they go through Ben-Gurion airport in or near Tel Aviv, or whether they go through on the eastern frontier of Palestine, which Israel claims is its own border right now, and pass through the Allenby Gate, that they will be held up and questioned at the very least. Similarly, anybody who's engaged in political work for example, an SJP member, or indeed a member of USACBI, the US Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, will be held up and interrogated at the border. Indeed, I had that experience myself passing into Israel a few years ago, and my group, all of whom belonged to both US and Canadian organizations that were fighting for Palestinian rights, we were all held up and interrogated. At that point, we were allowed entry, but other people were not. Other people, including Palestinians heading to the same academic conference in Ramallah, were actually denied entry. In other words, this is a really arbitrary set of policies. Some people may be let in. Some people may be let in after intrusive questioning. Some people may be denied entry, as happened indeed to a graduate student of mine who was trying to do research on the Palestinian youth movement a couple of years ago. In other words, it's a discriminatory policy that works in very arbitrary ways. And what that would mean is that any student who falls into any of these categories, that is religion, national origin, ethnicity, and in addition to those, any student who may have been involved in perfectly constitutionally protected organizing work on behalf of Palestinian rights might also be denied entry on the basis of their belonging, say, to SJP or to JVP. So it's our belief that running such programs and giving university funding or even moral sanction to such programs violates the non-discrimination and equal opportunity clauses that most U.S. universities, if not all, honor as a fundamental principle of access to education. And that's why we're targeting these study abroad programs in Israel and hoping indeed that people will join us in this boycott.
And again, SJP is Students for Justice in Palestine, JVP is Jewish Voice for Peace, and those are just two of about 50 organizations that Israel recently deemed prohibited from entering because of their activity in organizing on behalf of Palestinian rights.
The electronic intifada.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jim Loeb, journalist and founder of Loeblog.com, who discusses Donald Trump's appointment of John Bolton as his national security advisor and the implications for U.S. policy in Iran, Korea, and elsewhere around the world. Excerpts of speeches by students and a teacher at the March for Our Lives rally in Shelton, Connecticut, one of more than 800 events organized on March 24th, demanding the passage of common sense gun regulations. And investigative journalist and author Yasha Levine, who examines charges against Cambridge Analytica for harvesting millions of Facebook profiles and the larger issue of the unregulated collection of personal data for profit. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
An advancing Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan has triggered a wave of refugees who are fleeing the conflict. After four decades of war, over 2 million Afghans are internally displaced, and Western humanitarian aid agencies are scrambling to address the growing crisis. Increasing numbers of U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan have left residents in rural villages extremely vulnerable, forcing many to leave their homes. In response to the crisis, the Norwegian Refugee Council has increased its aid budget by $30 million to assist displaced Afghans. At the same time, Afghanistan has become a very dangerous place for aid workers. In late 2017, the Red Cross cut back its assistance programs after a series of deadly attacks on their staff. Ironically, the Christian Science Monitor notes, the Taliban capture of new territory has also meant relative peace in some areas, a fragile calm that could be disrupted by an influx of several thousand new U.S. troops deployed by President Trump with orders to fight and win. President Donald Trump and the Koch brothers are backing new measures in Congress to expand the role of private providers at the Department of Veterans Affairs. Veterans groups who support the VA's record on health care are pushing back, asserting that privatization harms veterans who need integrated care. Organizations representing veterans are now teaming up with progressive unions and single-payer advocates to fight privatization. Roberto Clack of the Right to Heal VA campaign says despite management problems, the VA provides quality care for the people who use it. Critics charge that privatization exposes sick veterans to lower quality care, longer wait times, and providers not willing to share medical records with the VA. Privatization, strongly backed by the Koch brothers and others on the right, could threaten 250,000 union jobs at the VA. Thus far, congressional Democrats have been able to block the Trump GOP privatization agenda and the transfer of $2 billion to what's called the Veterans Choice Program that promotes private health care for vets. During the night of October 11, 2012, U.S. Border Patrol officer Lonnie Swartz shot across the Mexican frontier from the border wall in Nogales, Arizona, killing a teenager in Mexico, Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez. Witnesses in Mexico say Rodriguez was peacefully walking down the street the evening he was shot 10 times in the back by Border Agent Swartz. After years of legal wrangling by the Rodriguez family, a U.S. grand jury indicted Swartz for second-degree murder. The case, now on trial in Tucson, Arizona, is the first time a U.S. Border Patrol agent is being prosecuted for a shooting death on the Mexican side of the border. If successful, the case could lead to foreign nationals winning the right to sue the U.S. government for American forces' deadly attacks on civilians in places like Afghanistan. The trial comes as President Trump continues to press Congress to pay for his proposed controversial $20 billion-plus border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. The activist group Southern Border Communities Coalition says U.S. border control agents have killed 50 people along the frontier since 2010, where no one has been held accountable. 4 years ago, an independent group, the Police Executive Research Forum, examined the use of deadly force by border agents, criticizing the agency for incidents in which agents opted to shoot at moving vehicles and rock throwers rather than avoid conflict. In those types of low-threat incidents, the group recommended prohibiting agents from responding with deadly force. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As Donald Trump continued to make major changes to the personnel in his administration, the firing of National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster last week created an opening for a critical position in the White House. That the president decided to fill that vacancy with the appointment of war hawk John Bolton was not so surprising, but was nonetheless greeted with concern and dread in the U.S. and around the world. Bolton, who served as George W. Bush's United Nations ambassador, is well known for his role advocating for the disastrous 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, and more recent calls for a military first strike against North Korea, and a preemptive attack on Iran's nuclear infrastructure. Bolton, a regular commentator on Fox News, has long opposed the 2015 Obama administration-brokered international agreement with Iran that halted the Islamic Republic's nuclear weapons program. With CIA Director Mike Pompeo's recent nomination to succeed fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and Bolton scheduled to start his new job as National Security Advisor on April 9th, there's widespread speculation that President Trump will decide to pull the U.S. out of the nuclear pact with Iran when he must decide whether or not to waive sanctions against Iran on May 12th. Your reporter spoke with Jim Loeb, the former chief of the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Interpress Service and founder of theloeblog.com. Here he discusses John Bolton's views on the use of military force as well as the implications for future U.S. policy in Iran, Korea, and elsewhere around the world.
John Bolton is a pretty unique character in that he's kind of the hawk's hawk. He even puts many neoconservatives somewhat on the defensive. He believes strongly in military solutions to political problems. He doesn't like the idea of nation building. And unlike the neoconservatives, he really is not into promotion of democracy, which neoconservatives have always given a great deal of lip service to, although sometimes there's been a failure to back that up, particularly with respect to certain countries that they consider to be allied to the United States. He's very much of an America firster, but he believes the U.S. military should be involved in the world and should be prepared to use force at all times. He's way to the right, very much on the militarism scale, even though he took some considerable efforts to avoid military service during the Vietnam War.
Jim, it seems there's an important date coming up in mid-May where Donald Trump will be on the spot to decide whether to continue on observing the international nuclear agreement with Iran or not. And he certainly sent many signals that he wants to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. What are the repercussions for that nuclear agreement with many other important nations around the world if the U.S. and the Trump administration does decide to pull out?
Well, I think it's a little hard to predict. A great deal depends on the position taken by the major European powers, Britain, France, and Germany, as well as the European Union itself, all of which are parties to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is the formal name of the nuclear deal. They were negotiating, that is the what is called the EU3, they were negotiating until last week on possible, quote, fixes, unquote, to the JCPOA. And even then, it wasn't clear that if they went through with those fixes, that Iran itself wouldn't walk away from the agreement. Because by its nature, any, quote, fixes, unquote, would violate what was agreed to in 2015 when the JCPOA was concluded. What is likely, what I personally hope, is that the nomination of both Pompeo and the appointment of Bolton will actually make clear to all concerned that the United States is really not serious about fulfilling its commitments to the JCPOA. And that will stiffen their spines. And if they show that they do have spine, that they're willing to counteract any U.S. renunciation of the deal, by counteract, that would mean essentially encouraging their companies to invest in Iran or to sell to Iran, and indicating in no uncertain terms that if the United States does anything with respect to increasing military tensions or actually taking some form of action in the region against Iran, that Europe will not be with them.
Now, the other very concerning policy issue that will be coming to a head quite soon is the planned summit between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. We're going to have John Bolton whispering in Donald Trump's ear in the lead up to that summit, whenever it actually does occur. There is a lot of danger, is there not, in a failing at that summit, which could lead to greater tensions than we even had before in the last year and a half.
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. I mean, Trump is uninformed, as we all know. Bolton denounced the idea of any negotiation with North Korea, let alone a presidential summit with North Korea. I don't think anybody knows what to expect, but I think Bolton will try to use this scheduled summit, if it does take place, to say, well, okay, we extended our hand and we didn't get everything we wanted. The North did not agree to denuclearize within a certain amount of time. So now we have to prepare for military action. And again, nobody knows how that's going to turn out because, of course, North Korea is actually a nuclear armed state with the ability to deliver nuclear weapons far and wide. I mean, the result of Bolton's appointment is if nothing else, our traditional allies, be they in Western Europe or in Northeast Asia, like Japan and South Korea, are going to distance themselves increasingly from Washington, even just because of Bolton and what he represents and how he's acted in the past. They're pretty frightened by the possible consequences.
That was Jim Loeb, the former Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of Interpress Service and founder of theloebblog.com. For more analysis and commentary on John Bolton's appointment as Trump's new national security advisor, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The March for Our Lives Against Gun Violence drew hundreds of thousands of students and their supporters to Washington, D.C. on March 24th, and to more than 800 other sibling marches across the country, in big cities and small towns, as well as cities abroad. The town of Shelton, Connecticut, organized their own March for Our Lives rally, which drew about 600 people to Veterans Memorial Park on the banks of the Housatonic River. Shelton is just 15 miles away from Newtown, Connecticut, where 20 elementary school students and 6 educators were killed in a mass shooting on December 14, 2012. The speakers in Shelton were mostly local high school students, along with one teacher, and staffers of 2 Connecticut members of the U.S. House of Representatives. House members, and especially the state's 2 senators, Richard Blumenthal and Chris Murphy, have been tireless in working for passage of gun safety measures in Congress, completely without success, until the Valentine's Day massacre of 14 students and 3 staff at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. That tragic mass shooting paved the way for the passage of modest gun safety measures included in the fiscal year 2018 appropriations bill, which was co-sponsored by Senator Murphy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the Shelton rally and brings us excerpts of talks by 2 students and 1 teacher who spoke there. We hear first from Shelton High School senior Tyler Monroe.
I am afraid to go to school every day because I overanalyze the goodbyes I say to my mother every morning. And as I walk up to that big brick building, I think over the lines I said in my mind, wondering if they were worthy of being the last words she ever heard me speak. I am afraid to go to school every day because of the plans my classmates and I have made. We hope to go into the military, or perhaps we already sent our deposits into our colleges. And I wonder how many of those names on those attendance lists will not be called because those kids did not survive to see this year's autumn. And I should not be afraid to go to school every day because I do not know if I will survive. Students should not walk the halls worrying about the nearest exit in case the PA system announces that there is an armed person in the building. Weapons do not belong in a building where the sharpest things should be students' minds. I should not be afraid to go to school every day because fear should not meddle with learning. The only worry that should ever exist in such an academic environment is the anxiety for an upcoming test. The information we learn should not be skewed in our minds because we are too worried about the fate of our lives. And I should not be afraid to go to school every day because the path to graduation is so uncertain. Schools across the nation are wondering which one will be next. And school is no place for the fear that my fellow students and I will not live to hear the dismissal bell ring. Thank you.
My name is Caitlin Botsford Tucker, and I am a social studies teacher and a mom. I'm so glad to be speaking to you today, but I am saddened by the reason for this march and the marches taking place across the country. 32 lives at Virginia Tech. One was a friend of mine. 26 lives at Newtown. 17 lives at Stoneman Douglas. The Department of Defense reports that the number of children killed by gunfire in the United States since 2012 surpasses the total number of American soldiers killed overseas in combat since 9/11. Last week, 7,000 pairs of shoes were placed on the U.S. Capitol lawn to represent those lives. Today, students across the country are making it clear
that they won't stand for inaction. They are making it clear that they want common sense gun legislation to make sure these tragedies stop. But it isn't easy. Students like Julia and Tyler know this. All the students here need to know it too. It's never easy. It's never easy to speak out when you see something wrong in the world. But you have to, because democracy is not a spectator sport. Movements are made up of moments. And you should know that this moment is important in this movement. Did you ever think you would be part of a movement? Because you are. You've organized, you've brought us all here, and you've made your voices heard. In my profession, we tell kids to believe in themselves. We tell kids to stand up for their beliefs. We tell kids to care about their community and the people in it. I'm standing here in awe of how well these students have listened. And I know that this is only just the beginning of what you can do. You're proving that you're up for the challenge. Because even when just two or three gather in the name of justice, there is hope. You are the hope for the future. Your voices will be heard, and you will make a difference. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Colby Tremblay, and I'm a junior from St. Joseph High School in Trumbull. Let's arm our teachers with resources, not weapons. Let's give them the tools they need to teach, not the tools to kill. It is a teacher's job to educate, not to fight for their lives and the lives of their students. So I ask all of you today, do not let this be the end of the conversation. We can be the generation that ends gun violence. We can be the generation that ends school shootings. This is our history. Thank you.
Those were excerpts of talks by students Tyler Monroe and Colby Tremblay and teacher Caitlin Botsford Tucker at the March for Our Lives rally in Shelton, Connecticut, recorded and produced by Between the Lines Melinda Tuhus. Cambridge Analytica, a London-based data analytics firm, which worked on Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, has been the subject of a blizzard of recent news stories, following revelations that the company harvested 50 million Facebook user profiles and used that information to micro-target voters. The company is owned by right-wing billionaire Robert Mercer, and Trump's former chief strategist Steve Bannon was a founder who also served as vice president. The company partnered with Alexander Kogan, a researcher at Cambridge University, who designed a personality quiz app, which Cambridge Analytica paid 270,000 Facebook users to install on their profiles. Data from those who installed the app and their network of Facebook friends was later used to target voters with political advertisements on behalf of Mr. Trump. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Yasha Levine, author of the new book Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. Here he examines the charges against Cambridge Analytica and what he believes is the more critical issue of giant social media companies' unregulated collection of personal data that is used to make billions in profit.
No matter how scummy these guys at Cambridge Analytica are, and they are scummy, there's no doubt about that. What the company does, taking data on people and using it to help shape elections and influence elections on behalf of some kind of client, usually a political campaign or a wealthy donor of some kind. What they do is no different than countless other political data-driven election companies do, right? This is very normal in this day and age to use these kinds of techniques, these kinds of psychological profiling, psychometrics, using data pulled from social media, right, and using that data with other data they pull from voter files from third-party data brokers, from the candidate's own donor lists that they compile. The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and various elements within those parties have their own companies that do this kind of stuff. You know, Charles Koch, for instance, lavishly funds, which is basically his own data-driven election influence outfit called I360. As bad as Cambridge Analytica is, it's just one of many players that are very similar, and it's not even the biggest. Well, the kind of data that Cambridge Analytica can pull, or had pulled on 50 million Americans, pales in comparison to the kind of information that Facebook itself has on those people. We have to remember that Facebook is in the business of surveilling its users, right, compiling profiles on its users, and then selling access to those users, to advertisers, and to anyone who wants to buy ads on their network for the purpose of influencing their decisions, right, to influencing them to buy a certain product or influencing them to vote for a certain candidate.
Tell us a bit of what we might not fully understand about the business model of Google, Facebook, any number of applications that we put on our smartphones, the games that we play, our cell phones and the use of cell phones on a daily basis. What is going on with our unregulated collection of personal data by these companies, how it's sold, and what are the negative consequences beyond annoying ads that might appear as you're browsing the internet? What are some of the consequences you're concerned about regarding this unregulated collection of our data?
Companies like Google, for instance. Google mediates a huge chunk of our digital life. We carry, a lot of us, 70% of the phone market, if not more, is dominated by Android, the mobile operating system. So 70% of, 7 out of 10 of people who have a mobile phone carry Google in their pocket, right? And Google goes with them wherever they go. And Google also mediates their phone calls, knows who's calling you. It mediates their web browsing, so it knows exactly the websites that you go to. It knows what you're searching for. A lot of people have Gmail, so they're emailing everything, right? They're emailing with their friends, with their colleagues, with their business partners, with their doctor, with their psychiatrist, with their bank, right? All that data, all the attachments in your emails are being scanned, are being monitored, and are being used to compile profiles on you that's being constantly updated, down to extremely personal information between you and your doctor. Google can know things that you don't even really put into the box. And so the level of information and the intimacy of that information that companies like Google, but also Facebook, because Facebook can collect much of the same information as long as you have the Facebook app running on your phone. The level and intimacy of that information is just kind of stunning. To just think about that, it's very frightening to know that giant corporations like these can collect that information. There are no limits on what they can do with that information or what they can collect. There are no regulations. There are no laws that limit or direct in any way the information that they collect on us. It's stunning, but it's true. You know, you don't have to really think too hard about why this is troubling, right? Because while companies like Facebook and Google have been able to sell a progressive side of themselves to cloak themselves in this progressive image, that they are these companies that are really, only want the best for the world and are trying to make the world a better place. And the truth is they are, giant profit-seeking corporations like any other. They're really no different than Koch Industries or Philip Morris or ExxonMobil in the sense that they are giant corporations that want to bend society and the political systems in which they exist to their will so they can make more money. And I think in a democratic society, no one should have that kind of power over the democratic process.
Europe has recently moved to something they call a GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation Plan. Are there any similar moves here in the U.S., and what, in your view, should that regulation consist of?
It's a good question. I've been actually trying to understand what this GDPR. I don't know if I can fully comment on that. But look, there are no moves in America. I mean, the closest thing that's happening now to regulating Silicon Valley and its for-profit surveillance business is what's called the Honest Ads Act. It's an important piece of legislation, I think, but it's very limited in that sense. It only applies to election and election advertising. But other than that, there's really nothing. There are no limits on what Silicon Valley can collect, the information they can collect on you.
That was Yasha Levine, author of the new book titled Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. Learn more about growing concern regarding internet advertising companies' unregulated collection of personal data by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Newton, Massachusetts, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal with an excerpt from the new book known as Murder Incorporated, Book 1, from Chapter 1, With God on Our Side. There is no doubt that religious fervor combined with the moral imperative to civilize a new continent infested with savages was a major force behind the European modus operandi responsible for the occupation, settlement, and subsequent genocidal maelstrom unleashed in the titular New World. But one doesn't need to dig too deep to find the profit motive rumbling like rolling thunder just below the surface. In fact, in all things geopolitical, it's like what Deep Throat tells Bob Woodward and all the president's men, follow the money. The same pretext and justification used to exterminate the indigenous population was also used to validate and defend the enslavement of Africans in the young and growing nation, a nation founded in genocide and built by slavery. Complete discussion in Chapter 5. Many tend to dismiss the horrors and murderous brutality of American slavery as an isolated antebellum southern thing or a misguided tributary of American history. But as Dr. James Horton of George Washington University sums up America's economic growth, which at the time was the envy of the world, quote, slavery was not a sideshow. It was the main event, unquote. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Hello, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. And I'm giving you an excerpt from the new book, Murder Incorporated, written by myself and my co-author, Stephen Vittoria. From Chapter 4, The Murderers of the World Arrive in the Americas. When the smoke cleared, over two-thirds of the dead were Lakota women and children. Wounded Knee would mark the bookend of the last chapter of the so-called Indian Wars. It would be the harbinger of a century of such bloodletting that the world would regard it as an era of nightmare. But long before Verdun, before Dachau, Treblinka, Manchuria, Nagasaki, or Hiroshima, there were massacres like Wounded Knee for five centuries, blessed by priests and promoted by politicians. The tormentors, genocidaires, rapists, and torturers were Spanish, English, Portuguese, and Danish. They were Europeans sent by a crucified Jew to vanquish paradise and bring hell to this green earth. They purified this new space with fire, blood, dung, and bones, and called it holy before the Lord. Of the people they met, who once radiated such beauty and health like demigods in a terrestrial heaven, they left a bare remnant, less than 0.5%. Their job done, they celebrated the death of an estimated 100 million people by pronouncing them savages and praising Christopher Columbus, the discoverer. An indigenous writer from the Maya would preserve the following words into the text Chilambalam regarding the white lords who invaded Mayan life. He wrote, "They taught fear and they withered the flowers so that their flower should live. They maimed and destroyed the flowers of others, marauders by day, offenders by night, murderers of the world." These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Abu-Jamal, and I'm here to introduce you to Murder Incorporated, a new book on anti-imperial history written by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria. Murder Incorporated, this is volume one, and from chapter six, I'm reading from the chapter called The American Revolution, Who Won, Who Lost. Americans of every stripe and fashion were always a pretty radical bunch. When you really consider it, only a radical bunch of folks could even think that the widely accepted idea, the divine right of kings, was bogus. Indeed, the poor and working people of the country, before there was a United States of America, were far more radical than those we today hail as revolutionaries and founding fathers. They were radical because they had to be. They were oppressed by an obscenely rich oligarchy, which thought of them as the unthinking multitude and the dregs of society. Those were the thoughts of the patriots too, wealthy men like Washington, Jefferson, Adams, Robert Morris, and Alexander Hamilton. Adams too looked down upon women, even if he looked up to his Abigail. But more importantly, he had personal thoughts of the revolution that no schoolchild in America has ever heard. Adams said, "The history of our revolution will be one continued lie from one end to the other." That's John Adams. For it was not a revolution in support of freedom, not for those most in need of freedom, captives seized in Africa. It was not a revolution to give liberty to the millions of masses who had no wealth. It took hundreds of years before they could even vote. It was not a revolution for nearly half of the country, women. Only in the first quarter of the 20th century could one seriously discuss their right to vote. It was not a revolution to do anything for Indians except exterminate them. It was not a revolution for those immigrants who swarmed this land to escape the class and religious wars that raged against them. Indeed, it wasn't really a revolution at all. It was a baron's revolt, a change of management from the British lords and ladies of empire. It was a fight among who would rule this land, who would be master, George III or George Washington, who would profit. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal for Murder Incorporated, Part 1, Dreaming of Empire, written by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Such as these emerge as my latest work is released into a waiting world. Murder, Inc., Dreams of Empire, Part 1, by yours truly and Stephen Vittoria, published by Prison Radio. I should have said our, for this work is truly the work of two minds, two pair of eyes, two psyches with one central thesis, anti-imperialism against the empire. Vittoria is a filmmaker and a documentarian who worked for years to produce a film capturing the voices of some of America's finest thinkers, like the late, brilliant Gore Vidal and the equally compelling Dick Gregory. But the film project never gelled, and Stephen, never one to waste gems, reasoned that the words of such gifted thinkers might have a second life in print. When he suggested we join forces and write a book, I was initially hesitant, but this was something I'd never done before. My earlier book, A Classroom and a Cell, co-authored with scholar-activist Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, was really a conversation made by months of recordings between us, of literally thinking out loud. This would be work, hard work, of research, reading, thinking, interpreting, and then writing our findings into the world as history. Such a project is hard enough doing alone, but two guys separated by brick, steel, coasts, experiences? As risky as it was a delicious challenge. Why not? Why not cast caution to the winds and, as the sneakers company put it in their ads, just do it? We split the work 50-50 and went to work. We read many of the same texts and either called or wrote one another. We resolved not to cut corners, but also not to cut harsh, unyielding truths. In the center of our work stood the presence of Zinn, whose The People's History of the United States informed and influenced our work. We envisioned not the U.S., but the world itself, more the empire. Why not? Murder, Inc., the definitive history of the U.S. Empire, was born. We have just begun, for there is more to come hot on the trail of this one. We think Howard Zinn would be proud. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour airs weekly on Winnipeg-based CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is also available for download at globalresearch.ca. This week, we mark the fourth anniversary of the death by suicide of an individual, investigative journalist, and independent media critic who served as a major inspiration for many in the post-9/11 period. His name was Michael Rupert. The son of a father and mother who were both deeply involved with America's intelligence agencies, Mike was given top secret clearance from a young age. He would attend UCLA and graduate with honors in political science in 1973. He would then pursue a career as a narcotics officer in the Los Angeles Police Department. He would be forced out in 1978 after blowing the whistle on CIA dealing of drugs within the United States. 18 years later, he would confront CIA Director John Deutsch at a public forum about these illegal covert activities. Director Deutsch's poor handling of the encounter reportedly resulted in his being passed over for a guaranteed position on President Clinton's cabinet. Toward the end of the 20th century and throughout the first decade of the 21st, Rupert's investigative reporting and analysis got distribution through a hard-hitting newsletter, which would become a website, FromTheWilderness.com. Eventually, From the Wilderness would begin touching on themes that would establish Mike Rupert's reputation as a dissident thinker and muckraking reporter. A former associate and longtime friend, Carolyn Baker, recalls that period in an interview we recorded and aired within days of Rupert's death. What are some of the maybe the standout moments for you that maybe helped embody what Mike was all about?
Well, just the incredible, impeccable research that he did. He was very picky about putting things out unless they were very well documented, and he certainly helped with understanding the Bush administration and that whole selection process that was not an election, but rather a selection. He helped all of us understand 9/11. You know, almost everybody who comments on their knowledge of Mike says, he's the one who woke me up. So the man really did a tremendous service for people in terms of awareness, raising awareness, and being able to document what he was saying. And we have the greatest respect for that From the Wilderness.
Mike Rupert would become one of the more credible figures extolling the claim that the 9/11 attacks were deliberately facilitated by elements within the U.S. government, military, and intelligence apparatus in order to furnish a pretext for what would be called the War on Terrorism. He released a popular video, The Truth and Lies of 9/11, and in 2004 released the book, Crossing the Rubicon, Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil. One of Mike's close associates during that time was a New York-based academic, writer, and scholar by the name of Jamie Hecht. We reached out to Jamie, who is now a psychotherapist with a practice in Los Angeles. We first asked about how he first came in contact with Mike Rupert. Jamie mentioned his exposure to the September 11th attacks and his conviction that something was wrong with the official story.
I came across Mike Rupert's work on the internet. It seemed to me more grounded and logical and courageous than anyone else's. It was clear he was willing to contemplate nearly unthinkable hypotheses about who might be responsible and how this might have occurred. And I contacted him, and the way I did it was I saw that he was coming to speak in New York, in Harlem, and by that point I was living in Harlem at the time. And I said to him, I'm not really a journalist. I'm a poet. I write academic scholarship about literature and the humanities, but I was radicalized in my teenage years by listening to Daniel Sheehan and Helen Caldicott and people like that. And I believe in what you're doing. I've read some of your work, and I'd like to work with you. I'm no journalist, but I've published some articles on Counterpunch, which I had at that point. He said, I don't normally do this, but I'm going to give you a shot. I have a good feeling about you. A few weeks later, he contacted me, inviting me to write my first piece for FTW. on a trial basis, he said, which was The Limited Hangouts of 9/11. He gave me that title, and I wrote the piece. And I wrote it with passion, and he liked the writing, he liked the thoughts, he liked the conclusions and the flow of the logic. And I wrote for him some more. Ultimately, he gave me the title of senior staff writer at FromTheWilderness.com. Later, he began calling me assistant managing editor as well, he being the managing editor. And I suppose that was a good fit. And as the 2004 campaign approached, Mike shifted into high gear with the book that he had long been meaning to write, mainly about 9/11, but also about the way things work in this phase of the history of the United States, Crossing the Rubicon. I remember the day that he and I, and I think two other staffers at From the Wilderness, tried to come up with the subtitle. Ken Levine was there, and I think someone else. And it took us about 10 minutes of rearranging the components of it until it gelled in my mind, and I went, okay, I've got it. Crossing the Rubicon, the decline of the American empire at the end of the age of oil. And we stuck with that. And that's how I met Mike.
Could you talk a little bit more about the personal side of Mike, the both the benefits and the challenges of working with him at Front of the Wilderness and Crossing the Rubicon?
He did have a lot of psychological problems from a trauma background that was pretty severe. He had been through hell as a kid, and it really left its mark on him. But it did not, I think, impinge on the quality of his work. It was a broad sector of his mind that was especially keen and oriented to reality. Indeed, more so than most of us are, because functioning well in this culture, as in any culture, but perhaps particularly the culture of late capitalism and imperial decline, requires a degree of ongoing self-deception that Mike was deliberately outside of. I call it deliberate, but I have to add that that kind of happy illusion that allows us to participate fully in what this culture is and does had been stripped from him by, childhood trauma, as I've mentioned, but much more so by the adult trauma of believing in its institutions, being a Los Angeles police officer, and being the son of an intelligence family, indeed a CIA family, and here I'm thinking of his mother, not his father, and experiencing both of those authoritative institutions unmasked as authoritarian, perverse institutions whose goals are the opposite of those that they publicly espouse. That's a trauma. I'll just add that there's a particular book that I've read about the psychology of whistleblowers that I found bittersweet, compelling, and extremely insightful. It's by a psychoanalytic sociologist named C. Fred Alford, Whistleblowers, Broken Lives and Organizational Power. And I recommend it to everyone who has been touched by Mike's work and who's interested in why it's so difficult for people to come forward in an influential way about state crimes against democracy.
Jamie, did you have much involvement with Mike after the Venezuela period? I mean, and From the Wilderness pretty much collapsed and went defunct. Do you have any recollections had you had much involvement with him after that period through the collapse movie, the radio show? What are your recollections from that period?
It was clear he was a changed man. The brush with death in Venezuela was not the first, but it was the most serious. At one point, with a capital T, if I remember correctly, did the old trick where they loosened the lug nuts on the right rear tire of his car somehow without his noticing, and he was about to get on the freeway and for some reason checked and discovered that sabotage had been done, and he was able to rectify it and drive away safely. Of course, at the beginning of his life as an investigative journalist, whistleblower, dissident, when he was still in LAPD, he was shot at, got a lot of death threats. But in Venezuela, it wasn't a question of whether or not the thing was going to happen. It had happened, and it was a question of whether or not it was going to kill him. And he went to Canada to recover. I don't know who took care of him, but they did a good job. And CollapseNet was his way of leaving 9/11 behind. He used to say, we got trampled by an elephant, but it's behind us now. The opportunity has passed. And he looked at the even larger picture of industrial capitalism murdering the living planet, a thing that figures like Derek Jensen write and speak about so well. But he did identify with Native indigenous American spirituality, particularly, as is well known, that of the Lakota people. Critics call his engagement with it cultural appropriation. They're entitled to that view. I think it makes sense along certain lines. Others appreciate his discovery of the great gifts that that culture bears. He was a great appreciator of it. And by some people, at any rate, in the Lakota community, he apparently was welcomed and given the name Tracker of Truth, which, as you can imagine, is a very good fit.
Jamie, I was wondering if maybe you have any concluding thoughts about the kind of legacy that Mike will leave behind.
Well, my belief is that he is the person who figured out how 9/11 was pulled off by the perpetrators. Others assumed reasonably that there was a stand down order, but the people who wanted to do their jobs on 9/11 were many, and some of them were at the FAA, and some of them were in the Air Force, at NORAD, and the Northeast Air Defense Sector. They would not have obeyed a stand-down order. Some of them would have disobeyed it. Mike knew that. He knew that that couldn't be right because it didn't explain the thing. And he looked for another explanation, and I knew him and was with him while he was puzzled at the beginning and then step by step figured it out. I was in the room with him when he was on speakerphone with Barbara Honegger, the author of the most important book about October Surprise, and that's its title, which through the 1980 election to Ronald Reagan. Barbara Honegger is the resident Air Force Base historian at Andrews Air Force Base. And Mike had a conversation with her regarding 9/11 aviation, the scrambling of fighter aircraft, which I was privileged to hear because I was there. Mike figured out that it was through the scheduling of a number, I used to know all these numbers, I don't remember any of them now, of simultaneous war game exercises right during the week of September the 9th, a time when several domestic and foreign intelligence agencies had warned the executive branch of the United States that there would be attacks using civilian aircraft as weapons to fly into a list of American buildings symbolic of American life, including the eventual targets. It was a list of 10, I believe. And the people who had those warnings included Dick Cheney. And the person who changed the rules about who can schedule war games was Dick Cheney. And the person who scheduled the war games in spite of the warnings was Dick Cheney. And the person who, as Peter Dale Scott has written, had his hands on parallel equipment underneath the White House in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, equipment parallel to that at the FAA and NORAD, was Dick Cheney. And the person who insisted that he and George Bush testify only in secret, unrecorded, and not under oath was Dick Cheney. So Mike Rupert wrote a book called Crossing the Rubicon that was a case, as he called it, of means, motive, and opportunity for the crime of 9/11 against Dick Cheney. hoping that it would throw the 2004 election. It did not. But his legacy was that if you paid enough attention, did enough legwork, and stayed in touch with the ethical drive driven by empathy for the victims, you could figure out how a state crime against democracy worked, and you could get the word out. Because not all of our First Amendment rights have been taken away just yet. You can still publish a dissident book. You can't get it reviewed in the mainstream press, because it wasn't, but it was the best-selling book on 9/11 for several years, with the exception of the Cain Report. And no major news outlet reviewed the book. They didn't attack it either, because they didn't want to draw attention to it. And as Mike pointed out, he was never sued for libel by the people he accused, because they knew it was true, and they didn't want it coming out in court. And that, I think, is not all of Mike's legacy, but that's the heart of it.
For a Canadian perspective, we caught up with Barry Silverthorne. He's based in the Greater Toronto area. In addition to producing the acclaimed Peak Oil documentary, End of Suburbia, in which there was a cameo featuring Mike Rupert, Barry had been a video editor and technician working behind the scenes on a special roundtable for the Vision Television Network, the first major broadcast featuring Mike Rupert talking about 9/11 and the first talk of his that I had ever seen. We got Barry to open up about what he remembers of Mike from that broadcast.
In the roundtable, I was really quite shocked at how easily he was able to take on Ron Adkey, who was one of the other guests, who was one of the people overseeing CSIS. And Ron got a lot of facts wrong in the discussion, and Mike was right on top of him, so it was fun to watch.
Yeah, the CSIS is Canada's CIA, you might say, and they're defenders of the official story.
Yeah. Yes, and he one fact that he got wrong, he actually was quite surprised to find out that there were still bombing raids going on in Iraq between the first war and the second.
I'm wondering if you might like to comment on Mike as a person, what really stands out for you that maybe might come as a bit of a surprise for some of our listeners.
It's not probably a surprise, but I found that his research was so meticulous and so well done and so well backed up. And, even when he did get things wrong, he was always kind of the first one to point that out and to make apologies and make good on it. I always admired him for that. As I got to know Mike, I found that he was a very complex individual. For example, when we wanted to interview him, and it was very hard for him to find the time. At the time, I thought we're willing to travel all the way to California and give you a venue. And he said to me later, this was months later when we met at a screening of The End of Suburbia. He said, well, the other people that I've talked to sent me a limousine to pick me up, and I was never sure if he was joking or, whether he was serious that we didn't treat him well enough.
Well, Mike had gone to Venezuela for a period. This is around 2006, and he'd gotten quite sick. He had to come, he had to leave, and his first stop was in Canada, and you looked after him during that time. And I wonder if you might like to share anything about what that experience was like.
Well, at the time, Mike seemed he didn't feel that he wanted to come back to the United States. He had already left the United States, and I didn't think that he felt particularly comfortable coming back. I remember meeting him at the airport, and he looked very thin and very tired. And the first thing he wanted to do was have a plate of ribs, because he had nothing but Venezuelan food for months, and he just wanted to get back to being, I guess, back in his old world again.
Yeah. So I'm sure he was very grateful for your assistance and cooperation.
Well, we went. We went shopping for, we went to the thrift stores for used clothes, and we made sure that he got some medical care. I took him out to visit some horses because he really enjoyed the horses. I put him to woodwork, chopping wood in the backyard, and, he spent a lot of time sitting in front of the fireplace, reading some books, and just resting up. While Mike was staying with me, we had a conversation one day. We were sitting out on the deck with our feet kind of dangling off the deck over the garden, and I told him this story about, I don't know where I'd read it, but something about when a bear attacks your campsite, you don't need to outrun the bear. You just have to be faster than the slowest camper. And Mike really liked that analogy. And it was interesting. For years after that, I heard him using that analogy all the time, and it always made me kind of smile thinking about that, you know, day when we sat there and talked about that.
Yeah, that is one of his more popular sayings, I think. So that's great.
And I'd love to know where it came from. If anybody knows, I'd love to know the source of it, because it's brilliant.
Now, I think you eventually conducted him back down to the United States. So I don't know if you had much involvement with him beyond that point.
No, he had to get some documents back to his lawyer in New York City, and we put them in a courier and sent them off. And if I had not seen this for myself, I would never have believed it, but it was virtually impossible to get this package to his lawyer in New York. It got moved to the wrong facility. He tried to track it, and it ended up in Maine or someplace. It's like you couldn't, the only way you could get this package that lost was through actually trying to do it. I mean, it couldn't happen by accident. So after a few days of trying to get these documents to New York City, Mike was, I guess, strong enough, felt comfortable enough to go back. So one evening after dinner, we got in the car and drove overnight and arrived in New York City in the morning. I dropped him off at Jenna Orkin's apartment and had a quick nap, and then I jumped in the car and headed back home after. On a personal note, when Mike left my house to go to New York City, he left some Venezuelan bolivars, some coins, in the dresser. And I still keep them there in a little box on the dresser as a memory of his visit and who he was and his story. And I think that was a nice little thing that he left behind and probably didn't cost him much.
Jenna Orkin, just mentioned by Barry Silverthorne, would host Mike Rupert for the next 14 months. Someone who had researched government and EPA impropriety around the environmental hazards associated with the attacks and affecting numerous first responders, Jenna had first encountered Mike Rupert during the 2004 citizen hearings on 9/11, where she was impressed by Mike's keen and discriminating analysis, and especially his research into the war games, which forced an effective stand down of aircraft intercept procedures. She saw Mike both at his very best and comforted him during his darkest moments. In the months following his death, she composed the account Scout, a memoir of investigative journalist Michael C. Rupert, with Against the Dying of the Light. What do you think was the key to his appeal in the eyes of so many who followed his work?
He was able to connect the dots like nobody else, and he was able to present it in a way that wasn't too highfalutin. It made sense. It made glorious sense and was somewhat revelatory. And also, he had enormous charisma that worked in his favor.
He seemed to achieve a level of notoriety around 9/11, after 9/11, as you pointed out. And then something seemed to go wrong. There was that incident where his the computers and his equipment and his office was smashed, I think it was around 2006, and that's seemed to lead to his departure from the U.S. to Venezuela. Well, you were close to him. What do you believe drove him to some of the actions that he ended up taking, and apparently to his detriment?
With respect to the destruction of the computers, that was during the time when he and Stan Goff were investigating the death by friendly fire of Pat Tillman in Afghanistan. And that investigation was then picked up by the mainstream media across the board and across the country, leading to the resignations or firings of a number, I forget the number now, so I won't venture, but Donald Rumsfeld left his position after that, and a number of others did as well. So Mike understood from the smashing of the computers that this is a warning, next time it'll be you. And he ran away to Venezuela, believing he would be given political asylum. And he just kept waiting and waiting and was told to keep a low profile. He would stand out as an American. So he had to stick around the hotel, and he got extremely depressed. And he was calling me every day, suicidal. And for the extent that I knew him in New York when he stayed with me for 14 months, he was suicidal every day, all day, for let's say the first 7 months. And the only thing that got him out of it was receiving notification that he would get his inheritance, that his stepmother had died. And I used that argument to keep him alive. It was like Scheherazade. Every time I left the house to go to work, I would say, okay, you're not going to kill yourself in the next 6 hours, right? And he would agree. And because he felt, you know, as a cop, he was a man of his word, he wouldn't kill himself in the next 6 hours. It was very much an AA, one day at a time approach. So thank God he didn't kill himself on my watch. But he was looking out the window and muttering to himself, I know when and I know how. And, you know, ominous things like that. It never left his mind. So if you were to ask what would he be doing if he were alive, I would answer he would be killing himself again. He would have done it, if not that day in April, what, 4 years ago? He would have done it the next day or the one after that.
As somebody who knew Mike very well, I was wondering if there's anything you would like to address in terms of the way he's being remembered by admirers and detractors alike.
The thing I'd like to correct the record about the most is what peak oil means, because many of his detractors use that to malign him and everybody else in that movement. Peak oil never alleged that we're reaching the end of oil. It said we're reaching the end of easy oil, and that has been proven correct, because the methods that they're using now to extract oil, despite the drop in price, economic price, the price environmentally has been enormous, and that's patently obvious from the BP disaster to, you know, gas and oil, well, and chemicals in people's drinking water and all of that. So that's not going to stop the detractors, but that's thank you for the opportunity to set the record straight there.
What are your understandings of you know, what made him tick? Could you maybe just give us some insights in that regard?
All right. Let me preface this by saying that I speak as a New Yorker, and if you know, if you've been here, you know that it's fairly common for us to go to shrinks, therapists, and I've spent a certain amount of time doing that and also reading about it, so I'm not a professional and don't pretend to be, but I'm certainly very interested in it. And so I will give you my 2 cents worth there. Mike's father left him and his mother when Mike was, eight, and the father would go off on these long business trips and then come back and go off again and come back. And Mike felt very abandoned, and obviously, as children do, he felt that if he'd been a better son or, you know, pleased his father in some way, Daddy wouldn't have left. Especially as Mike, for whatever reason, had very little respect for his mother. She drove him nuts. And when he lived with me, I reminded him of his mother, and I drove him nuts. He did not have respect for women, particularly women his own age. If they were much younger, then that was a little different. So he had this dichotomy, adoring the father figure, despising the mother figure. And he would talk about Jungian archetypes, and what I finally understood was that he was really talking about Hollywood stereotypes. And again, I think this worked both to his advantage and his detriment. So the archetype of the hero kept him going, but then when it failed to work, when he did not become the hero who turned around the ship of state, being the entire world, from its path of destruction, when those efforts failed, I think that's when the other side of him rose up, the suicidal side, which he considered his feminine side, because his mother was very depressed and she was on antidepressants. And when he was staying with me, the doctors were prescribing antidepressants and he was sleeping all the time as his mother used to. And so he loathed that image of himself, the feminine, the passive, the incapacitated. And so that view of the world where it's you're either on the top or you're on the bottom, I think that also destroyed him.
How would you sum up his legacy, maybe his crowning achievement, if you were?
Yeah, the crowning achievements were many, and they were very weighty. The website, which is now fromthewilderness.net, the main book, Crossing the Rubicon, the movie Collapse is well worth watching. And once you've seen those, decide where you want to go from there. And the other legacy that Mike left, which is very valuable, is in his disciples or colleagues. Well, they were first disciples and then colleagues. Rice Farmer is one. Mark Rabinowitz at oilempire.us, who has been a guest of yours, was a very esteemed colleague, and his websites are worth viewing. Nick Levis is worth watching and reading as well, Rice Farmer's website. So we all owe Mike an enormous debt for giving us the insights that he did.
You're listening to a special broadcast of the Global Research News Hour airing on Winnipeg-based radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is available for download on the website globalresearch.ca. This week, we are taking a special look at the life and legacy of investigative journalist Michael C. Rupert on the occasion of the fourth anniversary of his death, determined to be a suicide. In your book, Crossing the Rubicon, in the introduction, I'm just going to read a quote from it. I had studied how the investigation into the murder of President John F. Kennedy had been controlled. I had also personally painful and verifiable knowledge that the murder of John's brother Robert was a CIA operation. All the goodwill and energy of the researcher activists in each of these cases was deliberately and meticulously sabotaged by interested parties and their allies in the dominant political class. Mike, is it possible for you to just sort of help, you know, spell out that the nature of that sabotage, the pattern that you saw with the Kennedy brothers and what we've seen today with 9/11?
We're also seeing it with Fukushima.
Mm.
And we're also seeing it with climate collapse. This is the same machine that has always been there and available, and had available to it enormous amounts of resources, a tsunami of resources to throw at a disinformation campaign to muddy the waters and confuse people's perception, the purpose of which was to overwhelm, drown out in noise the people who were carrying the real message. For example, me. We have seen the rise of clear and extremely well-documented disinformation artists from Alex Jones to many others who have enormous amounts of money and resources to muddy and confuse the waters. If you go back to the 60s and the 70s, the government program called COINTELPRO, which was directed ruthlessly at the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement. It is has been abundantly documented. War Churchill, who I've met, did a great book on it. That the government, if you will, these are people who will be doing what they do. Don't pin it on one agency. It is a paradigm within every agency, but they will send infiltrators into campaigns to sow disinformation, to create discord and harmony, to sabotage operations, to muddy the message, to insert poison pills specifically. Peter Dale Scott was a mentor for many years, and he had a great line. Disinformation, in order to be effective, must be 90% accurate. People will eat a little tab of poison if it's wrapped in a beautiful, sweet, sticky cinnamon bun. But that poison will kill them nonetheless. And that has been the chief tactic used for many years. That's why I have so separated and isolated, put in quarantine, if you will, my own life's body of work so that it would not be contaminated by the enormous amounts of disinformation that have been sown not only into 9/11 and JFK and Bobby and Martin and everything else. That's the way it continues to work now.
Mark Rabinowitz, who was mentioned by our last guest, is a frequent guest on this program. He publishes the site oilempire.us, a political map to connect the dots. His site has an in memoriam section dedicated to Mike Rupert, among two others, and a lot of material which presents Rupert's investigative work in a very reverential light. He joined us from Eugene, Oregon.
Well, I first came across Mike Rupert's work immediately after September 11, when I was trying to find alternative opinions about what had just happened, because my immediate reaction that morning was to suspect some sort of covert operation. I heard him in person shortly after that at an event in Portland, Oregon. It was a presentation that became a video, The Truth and Lies of 9/11. And it was extremely impressive. If you go back and watch it almost 17 years later now, it still holds the test of time. I heard him in person a couple more times. He came through Eugene. I went to hear him in San Francisco. And we were on a discussion list that talked about these topics. Ended up writing a couple of articles for his newsletter, From the Wilderness. Even contributed a couple of points to his book, Crossing the Rubicon.
Could you comment on how your own research and analysis was influenced by Mike's work?
Well, I've found Rupert's connecting of the dots extremely powerful. And one of the first times I heard him speak, he was talking about how, since our society had chosen to avoid connecting dots, like the Kennedy assassination and other crimes of state, it enabled the perpetrators to keep doing more and more of these things. I've been aware of these types of concerns since the 1980s, both in terms of nuclear war plans, ecological problems, energy problems, the dangers of nuclear power, and many other things. Rupert had a very nice way of piecing these concerns together, which I found extremely powerful. Unfortunately, he was very disappointed that his work got read quietly in high places. The intelligence committees of Congress were subscribers to his magazine, but he didn't get the kudos and respect that he was hoping for, and took it very personally in many ways. And he was disappointed in particular that Crossing the Rubicon did not result in Cheney and Bush being denied a second term, since the documentation of suppressed warnings and overlapping war games with 9/11 in any rational world would have resulted in prosecutions rather than re-election.
So I think that for people who have followed Mike and been admirers of Mike and, who get clued into this whole idea of deep politics and deep state actions, it's hard to rule out the possibility that maybe this is a suicide that was – or a murder by the CIA or whoever that's made to look like a suicide. I was wondering, can we responsibly rule out that possibility given, everything that's out there?
I can understand why people might have a intuition that 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 is a more accurate description of what happened. But Rupert did write about feeling suicidal. I heard him in person say this a few years before he did die. So I have not the slightest doubt that he did kill himself. But I suspect one of the reasons was the profound disappointment that the world was going to hell in a handbasket and it didn't seem like things were shifting in a good way. So in a way, you could say that he fired the trigger, but it was the bigger social situation of the world that provided some of the rationale. I'm not justifying that. And I think one of the legacies of Mike Rupert is not just that he did world-class research for a number of years, but that if you're going to deal with deep politics and deep ecology, you need to have some deep inner strength and deep interconnections with those around you. And it's a complicated balance of being able to see the evil in the world and the good in the world and staying sane and stable as things unravel. Is, I can't overstate the importance of that.
Talking about people who go into this difficult realm, there's another figure named John Judge who, by interesting coincidence, had also died. It wasn't a suicide as far as we could tell. It was so much as a natural cause. John Judge, maybe you might want to just, give us a bit of a lowdown about what his work and maybe how that relates in some sense, that those dynamics may relate to Rupert.
Well, John was a similar deep politics researcher from a somewhat different path. They were roughly the same age. John died 2 days apart from Mike, and he died of complications from a stroke. He had been in ill health for a number of years. But his spirit was awesome, and he focused primarily on the assassinations of the 1960s. John also focused on 9/11 research. He lived in Washington, D.C., he spent most of his life there. His mom was even a whistleblower at the Pentagon. So like Rupert, he grew up in the shadow of the national insecurity state. But John also had the nerve to point out that some of the 9/11 claims were false, most notably the claim that there was a faked plane crash at the Pentagon that day. And he had the nerve not to compromise on pointing that out, despite the fact that there were 9/11 truthers who were unable to admit that they had been misled in the search for truth. And when you deal with these types of big topics, it's important to have skepticism not just of the official story, but skepticism of so-called alternatives to the official story, because sometimes they're not correct. Fake news is ubiquitous, and sometimes it masquerades as conspiracies exposing the truth. And John stuck to his facts, and it's a great loss that he is no longer with us as well.
I was just wondering if you, before we close, if there's maybe a certain memory of an encounter with Mike, either in person or through some sort of correspondence, you might want to share with our listeners.
It was a privilege to get to spend some personal time with him at a number of these events and to see his humorous side shine and to have some great discussions with him while he was preparing Crossing the Rubicon, which, despite everything, is still probably the very best book on what happened on 9/11. It's incomplete, but I strongly recommend it. Has his Truth and Lies of 9/11 film, which I believe is still on YouTube. But both him and John had incredible spirits in the face of collective denial, and their passing is partly a suggestion to the rest of us that we need to be more socially conscious about meeting people's needs for gently and respectfully talking about the deepest issues. And in a way, maybe we need to think about how to transform the psychology of this. And I'm a big fan of the truth and reconciliation paradigm for these sorts of crimes of state. And maybe if there was more social and collective interest in these approaches, then pioneers like Mike Rupert would feel more supportive.
Maybe, first of all, we should just allude to a certain metaphor that you brought forward. Basically, we're facing a crisis situation, and you made reference to the Titanic. Faced with a sinking ship, there are three groups of people you're likely to run into. The people who are in the deer in the headlights, freaking out, they don't know what to do. There are those who are busy making the lifeboats, and then there are those who want to go to the bar get a stiff drink because the boat is unsinkable.
Yes.
It occurs to me that there's probably a fourth group, maybe you could call them traditional activists, people who are trying to lobby the skipper to slow down and change course, or mm-hmm. working with the crew to try to fix the boat, or maybe some of them are in the bar handing out DVD copies of The Iceberg Conspiracy or something like that.
Very good.
There are people who get peak oil, but then they don't get peak oil. So maybe you could just go through some of the critical facts that people really need to know to really get their minds around the dimensions of this problem.
Well, first let's define the Titanic. And the Titanic is human industrial civilization. That's what's sinking. That is what cannot be prevented or stopped. And that's because of the fact of peak oil. Basically, very simply, peak oil is a point in the, all oil production follows a bell curve. It's the point where you reach the top of the bell curve, and after which, no matter how much money, energy, technology, wishful thinking, animal sacrifice, whatever you want to throw at it, nothing is going to increase the amount of oil that is produced.
In the final years of his life, Michael Rupert would develop a connection with Native spirituality and assimilate Lakota ceremonies and perspectives into his own worldview. He began to develop this connection in Crestone, Colorado, a small community in the Sangre de Cristo mountain range. He'd stated publicly that he had gone to this spot to die. However, he would eventually return to California, where he would continue with his weekly Sunday night internet radio program, The Lifeboat Hour. It was through this program that Mike connected with Portland, Oregon-based Mimi Gurman. Mike had admired her work on anti-nuclear issues and on the literal fallout from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, one of the issues about which he was most passionate toward the end of his life. They became close friends. She was the last guest Mike had on his show before his life came to an end that evening. The Global Research NewsHour got in touch with Mimi to get her share some memories and thoughts about the departure of Mike from this mortal plane.
We had lots of truth talks, Mike and I, and he had me on for that in the beginning, and then it kind of expanded from there. We just got to know each other, and he wanted to talk more, and I wanted to talk to him. And so in the process, we established a very close friendship off radio.
Did you ever think you'd form such a close spiritual bond with a former cop?
I like to look at Mike as a whistleblower and somebody who found truth. And so I don't look at Mike as a former cop. I look at him as somebody who found truth. And he went to meet that truth and be with that truth and walk in that truth. And that's the person that I met. He shifted our sensibilities, especially those who needed sensibility shifting to occur. He was able to do that, and that was his truth. That was the etheric piece of Mike. There's Mike the person, and then there's all of the energy that Mike held, and it's all of that stuff that is the shifter, the shapeshifter. And he was able to help so many people locate the truth of what we're doing here and what is happening here.
Well, you were one of the last people to speak to Mike. Your last conversation was on the Lifeboat Hour, I believe, and his very last program. Could you maybe talk about, you know, your reflections on that conversation and the subsequent news that he had died apparently by his own hand?
Well, I've been talking to Mike a lot that week, and on Thursday I called him. I knew about not his plans to die. I knew about his other plans, what was going on in that week, and he said to me that he was having Carolyn Baker, and he said, you know what, I'd like you to come on the show too. And I said, oh, I don't need to come on the show. Carolyn's an incredible speaker and has so much to offer and say. And he said, for sure. He said, but I really want you and Carolyn on together. And he was really adamant about it, because I was feeling that I wanted Carolyn to have all the space. You know, it was a show. We didn't know Mike was going to die. And he started to sound that Thursday and Friday a little bit frenetic. His energy was changing, and I felt it. And I asked him what was wrong. And you know, we had personal discussions about some things that, like I said, are personal. But I could tell his energy was changing. Something was happening, and there was great importance in this moment, in the now, in this show happening as it was about to to happen. And so I just went with it. And then, of course, as we know, he killed himself right after the show. So for him, what I do know, and some of the things he shared with me, as far as having two women who he, I think I can say this, who he cherished and respected, he had reverence for women and our place, and in from the beginning of time, and our knowledge and our closeness to the earth. And I think for him that was another piece of Mike's spirituality, and that was one of himself that he wanted to end his show with two women.
If he were around today, what do you think he'd be talking about on his show? What do you think he would be focusing on? What would he be saying about, if anything, about all of the developments that have been going on in the last few years?
I think he did already talk about all of this. That's the thing. To be ahead of your time means that you've already spoken about the future. And, of course, there really is no future. There's just today. So Mike has spoken about this. He spoke about this, about division. He's spoken about politics. He's spoken about oil and oil as money. He saw all of this. Any which way you look at it, it's been happening. Still happening, and it's going to continue to happen until we're no longer here. And that is what's happening. And he knew this already. I was going to say, if anything, he would no longer feel the need to talk about it. And look what happened. Mike no longer felt the need to talk about it.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about how you personally have gained and what the world has gained for Mike's presence on this planet?
I noticed this after Mike died. I should say after Mike left his body, because I really don't feel that Mike died. Sometimes people need to wrap that in a form of terribleness, in a form of anger, in a form of, making sense of something. And the only way to do that is to put your own junk on it, you know. I see no junk around Mike. Mike was a shining star who I didn't have an opportunity to know long enough here on this planet, but who I know is with me, and I know is with everybody if you allow that knowledge to exist in you. And that we all do not just meet up later, but we never leave each other. And so I miss him less now because of that, because I'm more in tune with that level of my reality, of that reality, that we don't leave the energies that we meld with, you know, that we get to stay with those. And when we leave the body,
we're still with that because energy doesn't die. And so, yeah, you know, I'm grateful for having met him. I'm grateful for the star alignment for lining us up, for him to call me and get in touch with me, and to be able to enjoy him in the time frame of, you know, Earth that I was able to, and to see how many people received his truth. I mean, for me, that was beautiful, to see how many people he affected, he shifted. And wow, I mean, good for him, you know. If we could all do that, we'd really be making change down here. But unfortunately, we're all still pretty wrapped up in the fact that we think this is kind of two-dimensional here, you know. We got a body, and we do these things, and we live in our chains. Mike wasn't like that.
Before we close this program, we wanted to hear from one more voice. Mike Rupert had fallen in love with a special woman named Jessie Ray, and she with him. A special note was left for her explaining his departure from this world and her life. She declined an on-the-record interview with the Global Research NewsHour, but expressed support for this endeavor and wishes to include the following statement. Mike was my friend. I think of him every day. Mike wanted to be of service to this world, and he did it the only way he knew how, with fearless passion and unbending dedication. I can think of nothing more attractive than that. He was a light in the dark to so many people, and he taught us to be vigilant. He changed the course of my life, and I'm forever grateful for the time we spent together and all I've learned from him, both in life and in death. This program is dedicated to Jessie Ray and to Mike's beloved dog, Rags. We've reached the end of this special edition of the Global Research NewsHour, airing on Winnipeg radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is available for download at globalresearch.ca. We've heard excerpts from previous interviews with Mike Rupert from the CKUW programs Here There Be Dragons and Global Research NewsHour. You can reach us with your feedback at globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Music this week was provided by David Bearwald. We'll end this show with one of his most popular songs. Thank you for joining us. My name is Michael Welch. Join us again next week.
Soon you'll forget me. I'll fade from your memory. And that's how it should be. You won't need me now. The world will embrace you. And lovers will chase you. Their kisses will take you where I could never go. Well, I never change. I'm forever the same. Hope you call out my name when you need me. And someday you'll be young again. And we'll play like we did back then. And fly far away, you and I, my friend. Someday, when you're young again. Let my love be no burden. Let me be your servant. Silent and certain as time ticking by. Like a star, let it guide you and hide it inside you. And know I'll be by to protect you from harm. Be never dark shadows or shade. Let sad memories fade till you need them. And someday when you're young again, we'll play like we did back then and fly far.